Good morning, everybody. I'm Jeff Young, Chair of the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. I would like to welcome everybody to our March 24th meeting in San Luis Obispo. Mr. Briggs, would you like to do introductions?
Can we start with a roll call?
That's a good one to start with.
Gary Shallcross. Here. Russell Jeffries.
Present.
Jeffrey Young.
Here.
Les Balker.
Here.
John Hayashi.
Here.
Monica Hunter.
Here.
Daniel Press. Absent.
Absent. Okay.
Dr. Press called a couple of weeks ago, I believe it was, or emailed and indicated that he had a conflict and would not be able to attend today. We just heard from Carol Hewitt, and seated next to Carol is Kelly Blackshear. She's learning the ropes for backup purposes. And then we have Michael Thomas, our assistant executive officer. Behind him is John Goney on the board. And seated next to me is Lori Okun from the State Water Resource Control Board, our counsel. And we have other staff present who we will introduce as their items come up. We have testimony cards that Burton Chadwick has in the back of the room there. If you could please fill those out for the item that you're interested in, give those to Burton or one of the other staff. And that will help because we'll know to call your name. We have today's agenda item 9 was the Morro Bay Cayucos Wastewater Treatment Plant. That item is deferred to a future meeting tentatively scheduled for May 11th. That was at the request of the dischargers, and we granted that request. But for the board members in particular, I'd ask you to please hang on to your materials for that item. We want to save some trees and not reprint all those materials. What we intend to do is simply provide you with an update of whatever is new when we get back to that item on Morro Bay and Cayucos. And that include, well, I'll just leave it at that. We do not have Jerry Secundi, our state board liaison from the state board, available with us today. And this is the time for all of us to think about whether our cell phones are on. If you could please switch those to either silent or vibrate or whatever, we'd appreciate it. And then also in terms of introductions today, I think we have at least a couple of new staff people, and I'm going to ask their supervisors to come forward and bring those staff people with them and give us a little introduction. So who wants to go first? Oh, we have a volunteer. That's David Athey bringing Cecile up.
It's my pleasure. Is this on? Okay. My pleasure to introduce Cecile DiMartini, the newest member of the Northern Point Source Landfill Unit. Cecile has a BS, Bachelor of Science from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in Environmental Engineering. Prior to her undergraduate degree, she actually worked at the Central Coast Water Board on GIS issues. She has 8-plus years of consulting with companies such as Tetra Tech, Locust Technologies, MacTech, and Levine Fricke. She has worked on projects in Mountain View, CERCLA Regional Groundwater Remediation Project. She has cleanup and investigation experience at the Hawthorne Army Depot in Nevada. And she has also worked on historical oil sump sites in the San Maria Valley. She works currently in the San Benito and Monterey counties on septic systems, wastewater plants, and other projects. And we welcomed her to the board. She's been doing a great job.
Welcome.
Pleasure.
What kind of cleanups did you do with the military?
With the Army, the Hawthorne Army Depot, I was involved in some mercury and lead remediation sites. And prior to me leaving, I was just about to be doing some mustard gas investigations, but I was luckily able to leave before then.
That's wonderful. Thank you. Welcome mm-hmm. aboard.
Thank you.
Sheila, are you up next? Sheila Soderberg.
Good morning.
morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'd like to introduce Rich Chandler. He's a new addition to the Spills Groundwater Cleanup Program. Rich received his Bachelor of Science in Geology from Cal State University in Humboldt. He's a professional geologist in the state of California. And he has over 17 years experience in the environmental industry, so he's going to be a real asset to our group. He most recently came from ATC in Santa Maria, and he worked on some oil field cleanup cases out there. He also worked at COMEX in San Luis Obispo, and so, of course, he worked on some of the high-profile MTB cases as well as the Olin perchlorate case here in our region. Rich is going to be working on the oil field beneficial reuse program as well as some oil field cleanup cases that are ongoing throughout our region. So I'd like to welcome Rich.
Welcome to the board.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Harvey?
Okay, I would like to introduce Allison Milholland. She is a recent graduate of University and Nevada in Reno. She got a master's degree in environmental chemistry. Her thesis was on mercury accumulation and exchange in grass and tree species, and some of that work is going to be published soon, she tells me. She also got a BS from Cal Poly in biological sciences, and she's going to be working on permitting issues in San Luis Obispo County, and so I'm sure you'll see much more of her in the future. Thanks, Allison.
Welcome to the board.
And David Licaro comes to us from Tetra Tech in the Santa Maria office. He worked there for about 5 years on NPDES, stormwater, and non-point source issues for various clients. He has a BS in ecology from Cal Poly. He actually worked here at the board as a student intern while he was going to Cal Poly. And he's working on permitting issues in southern Santa Barbara County. So welcome, David.
Next up is Lisa McCann.
I'd like to introduce Kim Sanders. Kim is jumping right into working on pathogen TMDLs in Santa Cruz County. And Kim also went to Cal Poly. She has a master's degree in biological sciences. And she was previously a consulting biologist locally here. She has expertise in botany, and she's actually quite an authority on California native plants. And she also was a nature program teacher at a program up in Cambria. So we're really happy to have Kim here with us.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I think that's it. We do have another staff who will be joining us towards the end of April, and that's Dean Thomas, I understand is no relation. And so we've had great success, I think, with recruiting efforts. I want to thank our supervisors for all the time and effort and energy they put in to this round of recruiting. We still have at least one point something vacancies, I believe, but we're doing our best to fill those. So we look forward to this new crop of folks working with the board. And I didn't go through the supplemental sheets, so let me do that. First of all, on item number 3, it's not on yellow paper, but for the minutes, we had two sets of minutes for you to adopt since we've had two board meetings in the intervening time. We just provided you with the January minutes in your folder. Fortunately, they're very short, but you might want to hold off till after lunch to adopt those, since you probably haven't had a chance to read those. So there's that item. We have on item 7, Furtado Dairy, we have a supplemental sheet. Item 8, Heritage Ranch, a supplemental sheet. Item 13 on Watsonville Slough Pathogen TMDL, we have a supplemental sheet. And I believe that's it.
But what about the February minutes? Can we? Yeah, they had those in the packet. Okay.
All right, so I suggest you go ahead and act on the February minutes, and then we'll come back to item 3 after lunch.
Mr. Chair, I can move the February minutes.
Okay. Second? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Unanimous. Okay, uncontested items calendar. We do have a card, Mr. Briggs, to pull the agenda item 16 off of the consent calendar.
Okay. Item 16 is the state revolving fund. So we'll not recommend approval of that one. Item number 8 is Heritage Ranch, which is on the consent calendar, and that's one where I mentioned we do have a supplemental sheet. Those are minor changes. One was a correction where it referred to investigating copper, and yet the table referred to some other constituents, so we corrected that. And then also in the monitoring reporting program, it had influent flow monitoring. It should have been effluent flow monitoring. I believe that's the extent of the changes in the supplemental sheet. And I don't have any cards up here for that one, so hopefully that's still okay for consent if those items in the supplemental sheet are all right.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to pull items 6, 8, or 15 off of the uncontested
no, it's not marked for consent.
Items list?
Mr. Chair, I have a question on item number 6, but I don't want to pull it off the consent.
Okay, Mr. Briggs.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and just see if we can field that one.
My question is that I know Gonzalez is expanding very quickly, and they're asking for additional capacity. Has there been any consideration for a reclamation project? This board has always looked at reclamation projects of using treated water. And I didn't see it. Did I miss it in the staff report?
I don't know if you did or not. Harvey or Tom?
And has there, if it's not in there, has there been any conversation with the city of Gonzales of somewhere in time?
Martin. Is it Martin?
Doing a reclamation project.
Martin Fletcher is available to answer that question.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board. At this time, the size level is shown that it's not feasible for them to do reclamation. They have in the order a continuation to always look at that option. They have a long-term wastewater management plan that they have to do for 2008, which in conjunction with their phase two expansion, which they have to look at reclamation.
All right. Thank you.
I didn't follow that. They don't have...
Currently, the size they're at right now, it's not feasible for them to move to reclamation compared to the infrastructure that would have to be put into place. With their phase two, they're looking to expand up to 3 MGD. This order doesn't address phase two except to require that they submit a long-term wastewater management plan in advance of them requesting phase two expansion.
Okay. Thank you.
With that, Mr. Chair, I will move the uncontested item calendar.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motion carries unanimously. We can now then move to item number 7.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Item number 7 is the Furtado Dairy, and I'm not sure what our status is as of this moment. We've heard that the discharger was going to wanted to address the board, and Matt Keeling has prepared this item. So what is our status as of this moment?
Actually, as of yesterday, the discharger did indicate that he was going to show up at the hearing. I don't see him or his consultant here present, unless I'm mistaken. But he did indicate that he was not going to address the board. He had an issue with one of the specifications in the order. When it was clarified to him yesterday by Mike Higgins, who was out in the field, he indicated that he was satisfied with that. He may or may not attend. I'm not sure at this point, but he did indicate that he was going to show up.
Matt, there was also an additional finding that I drafted yesterday. That's not in the supplemental sheet?
No, it's not. We didn't put one together yesterday.
Okay.
I think I got that at about 4 4:30, 4:40 yesterday. If you want, we can bring it up online and look at it.
Yeah, either that or somebody just needs to read it.
Okay. You want me to read that right now then?
Yeah.
Okay. You give me a second. I'll bring it up.
It should be in your folder. Okay. It's just missing attachments. While we're waiting for that document to come up, when we were talking about internally about preparing for this Furtado item, one of the things I asked Matt and Harvey Packard to check on was whether the monitoring wells on the site or the water supply wells or both had been sampled for chlorate, because this site is just south of Leavesley Road, just east of Gilroy, and it seemed to us that it was on the southern edge of the Olin perchlorate plume. And I thought that there, for one thing, the water supply wells for the dairy should be tested, since it's a dairy milk producing operation. And then also with the there are three monitoring wells on site, so they provide a valuable resource in terms of perhaps helping to characterize the southern end of the plume. As you might recall, that with the Olin perchlorate site, one of the problems has been that there are a lot of water supply wells that are ill-defined as far as screen depth and that sort of thing. And, of course, with a monitoring well, it's specifically designed for monitoring. That's valuable, valuable asset to have. So that's something we'll be following up on. Did you find the document?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. For the record, here's the additional finding that Lori crafted for us yesterday out of the order. It'll be finding 88 in the proposed order. It's a quite lengthy one, so bear with me. This order, you want to do that?
Actually, if you want me to read it for you, some of it I can summarize without having to read the whole thing.
That would be great, Lori. Thank you.
This is a finding about a cost issue that the discharger and his consultant raised in lining the ponds. And it says that this order requires wastewater ponds to be lined. The requirement in the current order is identical to the requirement in the prior order. There is no economic information related to cost of compliance that justifies failing to protect beneficial uses. The conditions of this order are required by the basin plan and applicable regulations, and are no more stringent than the provisions of the prior order, other than certain changes that were described in the staff report. And again, as to those changes, cost considerations cannot justify the failure to comply with these provisions. Findings 38 through 49 discuss impacts from the facility on groundwater and a program for the coordinated control of other nitrate sources in the area. The board has considered all cost information provided by the discharger, protection of groundwater quality solely through the coordinated control of other factors that affect water quality in the area would not be reasonable, since controlling these sources would not compensate for the discharges from the facility, that should say, or its impacts on shallow groundwater.
Okay, thank you. Is that it, Matt?
Unless there's any questions.
Matt, what seems to be the difficulty with this discharger taking his or her responsibilities a little more seriously? I mean, reading through here, there's...
You know, it's a really good question, and I don't know that I have the answer. I'm kind of on the fence with whether the discharger, one, just doesn't quite necessarily understand the requirements that he is supposed to implement, or he just doesn't feel it's important and doesn't want to do it. And I just can't get that impression, to be quite honest with you. And there does appear to be something of a history there. Prior to his ownership of the facility, his uncle operated it, and there seemed to be some issues that were worked out. But then, obviously, after the transfer in ownership in 2002, things evidently appeared to get worse. So,
okay, but this is on your radar.
Yeah, it definitely is, and we're in a position now where we're going to have to really be on top of him to make sure that he implements these revised waste discharge requirements. And we're also working with the district attorney's office. They're currently pursuing criminal charges against the discharger. It looks like that's probably going to go to trial here in April. A settlement agreement was not able to be reached with the DA's office in Santa Clara County. And I think one of the stipulations of his... or of the settlement agreement the DA proposed was that condition of his probation was that he had to remain in compliance with our order. So we'll have to be on top of that and work with the DA's office to make sure that he's meeting the requirements of his probation.
How often are you inspecting that facility?
I've been up there three times in the last 9 months. Michael Higgins was just up there yesterday. Because he's taking over that area for me. So he did a walkthrough to do a compliance check to make sure there were some final activities that he needed to implement as part of the cleanup or abatement order that we issued to him in June to get his operations back up to speed with regard to his waste management practices. And it looks like he's done those to the extent that he can at this point. The last outstanding compliance activity was for him to dredge the accumulated solids from his wastewater ponds, and it looks like he did that from at least half of the ponds, which has improved his capacity considerably from where it was about 9 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Where do they typically take that type of material and dispose of it?
Historically, what has been done with it is they will dredge it out and dry it on site, and then haulers will come that will either compost it or apply it directly to ag fields. One of the things that is required in the proposed order is we want to see a little more definitive tracking of how much of that material is produced and where it's going, and he's going to have to manifest that and provide those as part of his monitoring requirements to us.
And I noticed here that you've got a date of it seemed to be a general date of by the fall of 2006 for the complete removal. Does that mean September 21st of 2006?
Yeah, what
three ponds are to be
basically before the wet season. Okay. What we then did is we give him a little bit of a variance on the compliance activity to remove all the solids from his wastewater ponds. Because the ponds were full, it made it very difficult for him to go in there and remove those solids. What he was normally supposed to do on an annual basis is draw down one of the two banks of ponds that he had while having one of the existing banks in operation so that he could pull those out and he would get some drying in effect before he pulled them out. And since those ponds were totally inundated, it was difficult for him to get in there and get the solids out. So we basically said we want to see half of the ponds excavated down to their original design depths immediately, and then coming into next summer, he would be able to draw down and dry the other ponds and remove the solids from them prior to the coming wet season of 2006.
Okay. Mr. Schalkrum.
I'm not finding it here right now, but I recall
original construction of those ponds and what soils were used. And if you can't do that, to provide soil samples from the pond embankments that meet those requirements for the minimum clay and the maximum gravel.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That was it.
Okay. And is there a deadline for him to provide that information?
No, we didn't specify one.
It sort of bothers me that, you know, you're asking for information and not having some sort of deadline.
Well, we didn't. Initially, we didn't think it was an issue because, like I said, it was in the existing order. And as outlined in our responses to the comments about that requirement that were submitted by his consultant on his behalf, earthen line ponds, there's a small amount of leakage that does occur. And over time, the surface tends to blind, and it decreases the infiltration through those ponds as the solids build up. But if you like, we can address that.
I mean, if you're comfortable with just having an open-ended request for information, with this person, that's
why not
I
have
guess
a
that's
date.
Okay.
Certainly.
What would be a reasonable date to provide that?
Well, I think what we can do is, in line with him having to remove the solids from the second bank of ponds, we can look at it sometime this summer or this fall, and he can coordinate that with, you know, if he has to go in and reconstruct the ponds that. You can do it this summer, so probably sometime this spring would be appropriate. Say the end of May. And that should give him enough time to get his consultant out there to collect some soil samples and run the geotech analysis.
I mean, whatever you think is a good length of time, I just think there should be some sort of date by which
Absolutely. This
information's due.
Okay, well, we'll establish that in the. And the requirements to submit that date, end of May.
And let him know that this is a new requirement.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mr. Jeffries.
I had a couple questions, and, of course, talking about draining the ponds to check to make sure what kind of material was in there. I see that they had several violations of illegal discharges to the creek, and I hope they wouldn't pump these ponds into that creek again. Has there been any of those since May of last year?
Not that we're aware of. Fish and Game has been out there on a regular basis, as well as the Santa Clara Valley Water District. Their offices are up there localized, and they have just as much interest in this as we do.
And I noticed also there's been several incidents where the cows have got into the creek. Has he fenced that off?
That was corrected some years ago. Based on notices of violation that were issued by my predecessor, I think back in
the last time you were there, that was still the case?
Yes, that was the case. They were adequately corralled.
Okay.
Any other board questions? Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. Sorry. Just a little bit into the background of this, I'm just wondering, when did the waste discharge requirement 8601 expire? Because I noticed in the summary of the situation, it's been 20 years, and I can see
the waste discharge requirements for this order, but I had to kind of go back to the drawing board and address some of the issues that came about from the release in May.
So there is no expiration on these, so it's a matter of tracking them. And also, there was a period of time where this particular operation was discontinued. And does that trigger any further kind of oversight when the operation kicks up again and begins to operate with new?
It should have, quite honestly. I'm not so certain why we did not rescind the order when the previous owner signed up for the dairy buyout program. I think that was in the late 1990s. I forget the exact date. It's in the staff report. But obviously, when they did restart, they should have notified us. And that wasn't – I can't find any record of that in the order. I think what was going on is that staff were periodically going up there and stopping by the facility to verify that there were not any cattle on the facility. So there is a record of inspection reports that say that the facility was not in operation during that time period.
Okay, thanks. I'm just curious about, you know, thinking about the region generally, you know, how these kinds of operations are monitored, and then what are the trigger points for keeping a closer eye on changes that are occurring or work that isn't being done under the discharge requirement. Thank you.
Just a reminder that the NPDES permits do have a 5-year life and expiration date, not so with the waste discharge requirements. Also, Matt mentioned his predecessor, I believe that was Matt Fabry.
Kimberly Gonzalez, and then before that it was Matt Fabry, and going on back, there's been a rather high turnover for Santa Clara and San Bernardino counties.
And the board, I guess the other board members will remember that we've had pretty intensive staff and board time associated with Hollister and South County Regional, which were pretty time-consuming from a staffing standpoint. So that, you know, there's an effect on other facilities. I think that was part of the problem with not providing as much oversight as we probably should have.
I have a question on the due date for the lining of the pond. What mechanism were you suggesting to impose that requirement?
I think I was just going to add an additional standard provision.
And there, okay, so
I don't think it was necessary
the
for the lining of the pond. It was for documentation as to the current construction of the ponds to see whether or not it meets the specification for the minimum lining requirements.
And if it doesn't, what will the deadline be for correcting that? Because if there's a deadline for meeting this requirement, it should, and it's not right now, it
that's
should
a good
be
point. So that was kind of my thought in putting it for this in the spring. If we do find out that it doesn't meet the minimum requirements, then he's got all summer to dry out all or a portion of the ponds and go in there and reconstruct them before we start going back into the wet season. So that is certainly appropriate to have an additional trigger.
My only question with all this is this particular dairy has had a history of non-compliance, period, and non-response. What makes you think that he's going to do any of this?
Quite honestly, I do have my doubts. I think the way the order is written, it's a very stringent order. I think it's appropriate given his history.
Oh, I don't disagree.
And I think he's going to have to spend an equal amount of time now managing his waste at the facility as he does producing milk, and that's going to be quite a burden on him. But, you know, it's up to us to make sure that he conducts his operations appropriately and that he's not going to impact
you
surface
mentioned
groundwater.
You mentioned a consultant quality. Earlier in your presentation. Has he a consultant now?
Yeah, he does. In response, so actually prior to the issuance of the cleanup or abatement order, he had a consultant that was working on submitting to us a report to waste discharge for his permit renewal, and then he carried him over to help implement the compliance activities specified in the cleanup or abatement order.
Any other board questions? Okay, Mr. Briggs.
So, if it's all right with the board, our counsel has suggested that instead of changing the order, that we issue him a 13-267 letter, which is enforceable, by the way, and that the order should be sufficient as written. So, the only changes that we're recommending, correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, but it would just be the inclusion of the attachments, which are the supplemental sheet.
Yeah, the inclusion of the attachments as well as the additional finding that Lori recited for us. Excuse me.
Thank you.
Okay. That's our recommendation?
Yes.
Do you have any cards?
No.
It doesn't look like it. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to address the board on this issue? Okay. And Matt, is the discharger here?
Not that I can see.
Okay. All right. I'm ready for a motion.
I'll move the staff recommendation.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Great.
Thank you,
Matt.
Have a good day.
Motion carries unanimously.
Thanks, Matt. Item number
10, I think, right?
Yes. Item number 10 is the low threat and general waste discharge cases. We have four categories listed here. The first group are low threat general permits. There's a hydrant flushing one for City of Santa Maria. There's the groundwater dewatering for Dove Creek in Atascadero. And there's the Los Osos CSD underdrain system discharge. Those are notifications of enrollment in the general permit for your information. We have also notification of enrollment in a low-threat general waiver for this Osterly, I guess it is, horse stable. We have notification for you of two staff closed cases, and that's good news. That means those facilities completely meet groundwater. If not, we can go on to item 11.
Okay. All right, why don't we do that? Item number 11.
Item 11 is our regular perchlorate cleanup sites report with our four facilities described in terms of the most recent status, and I believe we're just counting on a written report today. We do plan on having a more in-depth a staff presentation at our May board meeting, which is going to be up north. So that'll be an opportune time for perhaps some of the folks interested in that from the north to come to our board meeting. Any questions on our staff reports?
Okay, it doesn't look like it.
Item number 12 is corrective action plan for the former J's Gas and Save. And this is also a written report. Oh, there's also the City of Watsonville parking lot. Both of these are staff engineer John Maharis's sites. Any questions on those?
Doesn't look like it.
You're on a roll.
Yeah. This board's just being way too agreeable this morning. Item 13. Ready for item 13?
We're ready for item 13.
Okay, we do have a staff presentation for item 13. We don't have any cards on it, but I understand that there are some folks here who are interested in hearing the presentation and then also will perhaps comment, and they're interested in any board feedback. This is the Watsonville SLU pathogen total maximum daily load item. And seated at our front table here, the supervisor who directs our total maximum daily load program is Lisa Horowitz McCann, and our staff person who prepared this item. And is this your last TMDL presentation? Well, for the time being.
Yeah, it could be for quite some time. I hope so.
Not that Dominic is leaving.
You know what I mean. I hope I can do my other job.
He has some other duties in the office. But anyway, Dominic Rock has prepared this item and will be making the presentation this morning.
Well, thank you. I think the lights are going to... Great. Which one is it? This one? Cool. Great. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Thank you for hearing me out on this. We have a recommendation today, which is a basin plan amendment, but it includes three distinct pieces. The first is the adoption of a pathogen TMDL, or total maximum daily load, for the Watsonville SLU watershed. And that would include the numeric targets, the implementation strategy, the allocations that go with that. The second piece is the approval of a beneficial use change. In this case, we're asking for the removal of the shellfish harvesting beneficial use from the Watsonville SLUs. And the third piece is the adoption of a watershed prohibition on livestock waste discharge. Just in an East Branch, Hanson SLU, Harkin SLU, which is this larger one that includes some upland kind of stream-like and valley characteristics, Galligan SLU, and that is and Hanson SLU, the small one toward the middle of the screen. Oops. There we go. The city of Watsonville is the dark gray shaded area, and that sits over the watershed's of both the Corralitos and the watershed slough. Corralitos is just that fragment of the watershed over there. The rest of it is in Watsonville slough, primarily in the Watsonville slough and the Struve slough systems. You can also see the Pajaro River coming down below this whole system, which is an entirely separate watershed, and it all flows to Monterey Bay. This Google Earth view is useful in seeing how the urban landscape interacts with the agricultural and other land uses. And again, there's a portion that includes the Corralitos watershed. But when we overlay the slough system itself, you see that Watsonville, the city, actually occupies a substantial portion of the upper watershed. Let's see here. Oh, the Pajaro River was down there. Altogether, there are about 13,000 acres of land under urban agriculture and rural land uses. And there's increasing development pressure on the sloughs that's placing more and more people in closer proximity. You might note this is a development here, is a residential development right there on one of the main lobes of the system between the east and west branch of Struve Slough. The system does have its outfall, so to speak, at the mouth of the Pajaro River, right where it enters Monterey Bay. Behind the Pajaro Dunes, there's the slough itself and the Pajaro River. This has a typical coastal seasonal closing and opening regime. But that connection is somewhat less significant than it would be, because now there's a significant modification of the system with tide gates and pump stations, as well as land subsidence. These all constrain the natural circulation of the system. And in this case, Harkin Slough, this is actually a water body with aquatic vegetation on it. And it's backed up behind a pump station, a Harkin Slough pump station, that's harvesting water and transporting it out of the basin to a recharge zone to prevent saltwater intrusion. So the modifications in this system are fairly extensive. And they are an important part in affecting water quality overall. Subsidence has had an effect. This is a high water condition, so you wouldn't necessarily notice the degree of subsidence normally. But quite often, if not, I think perennially, Lee Road is underwater permanently. And this has had the subsidence has actually been caused primarily by peat oxidation and groundwater pumping. So depending on where you encounter the sloughs, you might be tempted to go. So this brings us to the first part of the recommendation, which is the adoption of the TMDL. And I'll go over the three key pieces that are relevant to the presentation: the source analysis, the establishment of numeric targets, and the implementation plan. Our source analysis relied on three approaches: land use evaluation, to look for sources through simple land use evaluation, grab sampling of both storm events and ambient conditions, and a limited genetic analysis, which looked for specific markers of host-specific E. coli. We only had three sites that were looked at, both in the dry season and the wet season, and had a total of 16 samples for analysis. But using these three types of analysis, they all pointed in the same direction, or to the same conclusion, namely that there are substantial controllable sources in the watershed, including human, pet, and livestock sources, and that the bird component was a significant component as well, a natural background condition, if you will. As you know, numeric targets in TMDLs will rely on existing water quality objectives where they're available. So we'll go directly to our basin plan, and we'll pull a numeric or, in some cases, a narrative criteria from the basin plan and use it as a numeric target. Well, in this case, that would have had us using the shellfish harvesting beneficial use and its associated water quality objective as our numeric target. And because of things we knew about this system, the degree of hydromodification, the type of substrate available, and the lack of any awareness of any shellfish harvesting, We were very doubtful that the shellfish harvesting use was appropriate. This brings me to the second part of the recommendation, which is asking you to approve a removal of the beneficial use for shellfish harvesting. We concluded that removing the shellfish harvesting use was actually a necessary step to completing the TMDL. But this is not something you approach casually. It's a federally prescribed process. The United States Environmental Protection Agency has ultimate authority of approval over all use changes, and they have a very conservative approach toward changing swimmable and fishable uses. But they have outlined a process called a use attainability analysis, and it asks some key questions. Are the uses attained? Are they being currently attained? In this case, there are no records, and there's no knowledge of shellfish harvesting that we could find. My colleague, Shanta Keeling, was the principal author of the use attainability analysis. And she'll be coming in shortly, but she did some legwork on this to find sources of any historical data that might support the claim that there was shellfish harvesting, and the answer was categorically no. Secondly, is there water quality that is sufficient to support the use? And from 1976 to the present, Watsonville Sloughs has never achieved the Department of Health Services standard of 14 most probable number of coliform units for which is in effect the shellfish harvesting standard. It's never achieved that in any of the data. So we could say it doesn't support it from a water quality point of view. And thirdly, are there other factors that preclude the attainments to do the homework and actually confirm that those uses were supportable in those environments? So in some cases, the assignment of use is probably inappropriate. We happen to think this was one of the cases. Our conclusion ultimately was to remove the use. And with the shellfish harvesting beneficial use removal, the next use of relevance is the body contact recreation use, and that's called Rec 1 in shorthand. So that became the basis of our numeric target. We do consider this to be a conservative target, partly because there are high background loads from birds. And at certain times of the year, this indicator is really just an indicator of bird populations. It's not necessarily an indicator of human pathogens. Second, body contact with the water in Watsonville Slough is fairly uncommon. I would say very uncommon. This might be because it is somewhat uninviting water body, as that left picture is meant to portray. But it's also because the city and the county, but particularly the city, which has the denser populations, they generally discourage body contact recreation in their educational materials about the slough system. And they even include these discouraging words: visitors or pets are not permitted to swim in the wetlands. Nevertheless, we are going to stick with this conservative approach for a couple of reasons. One is we consider the potential for contact recreation to be very real, in particular as increasing population, as you saw from that residential development, increases the proximity of people to water. We think the incidence of contact is greater. And secondly, if we are to use a less stringent water quality objective, it requires that we actually remove the Rec 1 body contact beneficial use. And we don't have adequate evidence to suggest that that's appropriate, as we did with shellfish, for example. The implementation focus of this TMDL is on controllable sources. And so this TMDL seeks to reduce anthropogenic sources to the point that body contact recreation is protected. But we have to do this in a pollutant source context that is has very high background loads, it has very diffuse sources, and where the fate and transport of pollutants is mediated by a highly variable hydrologic condition. And that's variable not just because of natural conditions, but because of the modifications. For example, the interbasin water transfers. They've significantly altered the way water flows through the system. But we think we can do it. We do believe that it will require an adaptive approach an implementation approach over 10 years' time that focuses controls on anthropogenic sources and moves forward with monitoring and assessment to help us improve the selection of those efforts to control sources. With regard to human and pet sources, we're focusing on urban stormwater programs to include education, and we're asking, certainly.
Is this area, and you could go back to that photograph, is an area like that sewered?
Yes, it is.
It is.
This, the entire city of Watsonville is on sewer. There may be an isolated parcel here or there, but it is a sewered city. The rest of the watershed, which is, of course, considerably less dense and undeveloped or under agricultural use, is mostly on septics.
And is it in areas where there's this much surface water during the wet season? More so?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
Well, in the areas where there are septic systems, mm-hmm. on-site disposal systems, mm-hmm. Do those areas have as much surface water appearing as we see in this photograph?
The majority of rural residential septic-based land use is in Larkin Valley, which is in the headwater areas of Larkin Slough. In that environment, it's more of a stream-type lodic system. We did not focus on on-site waste systems as a primary source, partly because there are existing measures that address those at the county level. There are county ordinances that are looking for performance, particular performance objectives, and there's also a move to make more stringent those requirements at the state level. It did not appear to be a significant threat to the slough system in the wetland portion. But you don't see these big ponded areas in that portion of the watershed. It's more like a stream that runs in a ephemeral manner. Our measures that address livestock operations and farms that spread manure require that these folks develop and implement containment strategies for their manure or their waste, that they produce grazing management strategies if they actually have grazing animals, and that any plan that they develop include feedback mechanisms which allow us to understand the effectiveness relative to water quality of those measures. We really need some assurance that if manure is being spread on agricultural fields, that there's some mechanism in place, either a composting of that material that makes it sterile or a buffer of some sort that prevents it from its most direct pathway into the water body. And this is this is a slough, by the way. It's not a paved area. This brings us to the third part of our recommendation, which is that you adopt a prohibition on livestock waste discharge as part of the basin plan amendment. The regulatory tool that we're using for portions of the implementation plan addressing point sources, namely stormwater, are NPDES permits, or WDRs in a couple of cases for a landfill. But we don't have a similar existing regulatory tool for the non-point source discharges, so this requires that we develop one, and we've developable sources. The stormwater entities will be monitoring their discharges or some representative sample of their discharges. They will be designing a monitoring program or strategy. They will submit that to us for approval. So the monitoring strategy in the TMDL that you may have reviewed is more or less a straw proposal for them. Other non-point source discharges, will monitor their discharges or receiving waters or develop and present some other evidence that they are not discharging pathogens to water bodies. We received public comment, primarily loudest comment, I should say, was from local agencies who had concerns that the body contact recreational use was inappropriate because birds will prevent us from ever attaining the TMDL. They also had reservations about the TMDL because it failed in their minds to adequately differentiate between the controllable sources and the uncontrollable sources in terms of who's responsible and what implementation practices will be used. Well, our response to them has been that we stand firm on the use of the water quality objective for body contact recreation. We don't think that that should be removed. But we did agree that wording changes in the resolution could help clarify the issue and make clear that the influence of uncontrollable sources in keeping fecal coliform levels above the Rec 1 standard will occur in parts of the year. We've actually included those word changes in the supplemental sheet that was provided to you before today's meeting. The county and the city have both expressed their satisfaction with those terms and the changes, and they've agreed to work with the Water Board to implement these programs and to develop a robust monitoring strategy, because they are as much interested in resolving this as we are and understanding particularly the relevance of the natural sources versus the controllable sources. The United States Environmental Protection Agency had some minor comments, but in general, they said that the TMDL and the use attainability analysis did support or was in their minds consistent with the Clean Water Act requirements. They thought that the TMDL analysis supported the allocation decisions we made, and they do anticipate approval of the TMDL and the sustainability analysis at the federal level. Again, I'll conclude with a reminder that this is one basin plan amendment, but includes three distinct parts. One is the adoption of the TMDL. The second is the approval of the beneficial use change and the removal of shellfish harvesting as a use. And the third is the adoption of a watershed-specific prohibition on livestock waste discharge. With that, I'll take your questions.
Okay. I'd like to hear from Shanta about what research she did to determine that there was no historical shellfish and beneficial use.
Would you like to sit here?
I
have the report, too.
Sorry, I don't know if I'm adequate. Okay. Okay. I'm sorry, I wasn't actually sure I was going to present or not. So,
Dominic used your name quite frequently before you arrived here.
We contacted, I'm sorry, I'm out of breath. No, it's okay. It's just, I apologize. I contacted the Department of Health Services, and there's never been any commercial shellfishing in the area, and they didn't know of any shellfishing that went on previously there. Contacted the Department of Fish and Game. They, again, didn't know of any shellfishing that occurred in the area. Contacted the Moss Landing Marine Laboratories, and then also I believe the person I contacted off the top of my head asked some of his colleagues if he knew anything, any shellfishing occurring there, and I don't believe anything. Should look back at the notes. Also, I'm just sort of reading down the other agencies. There's another person, Julie Hagar, who works for the Monterey Bay Watershed Institute, and they did quite a few. Maybe Dominic can refresh my memory. They did quite a few surveys out in the area, a lot of sample collection, and all the times that they were out there, they didn't see anything, any shellfishing occurring out there, or any, and the presence of any shellfish. And then also Robert Ketley with the city of Watsonville confirmed that as well. Also, one other thing that I guess I'd want to point out is that the slough, all of the Watsonville slough and the tributaries that we're proposing to remove for the beneficial use of shellfishing is all freshwater. So because of the tide gate, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, it's all freshwater. So the typical shellfish you would see in an estuarine situation probably would be unable to survive there. So,
can I add, is this on? Can I add one thing? I think the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is also concerned about the thoroughness of these kinds of surveys. I brought this use attainability analysis to a workshop at Region 9 in San Francisco in July as a case study of use attainability analyses and in a workshop that addressed, in general, the removal or the changes to beneficial uses. And one of the questions that came up was, well, that's not a designed survey, that's more of a sampling. And they thought it would strengthen the use attainability analysis to have a more, forgetting the terms, but a methodology that's actually approved sociological methodology for surveying. But my response to them at the time, and I continue to stand firm on this, is that I think there is a weight of evidence approach that you're using when you're evaluating these uses. And when you look at the first step out of the gate for the shellfish harvesting use, it doesn't make sense there. It sort of doesn't quite add up either intuitively or based on the common knowledge of people in the area. And then when you look back at how it was made at a time when we were kind of not willy-nilly, but perhaps too quickly making these decisions in an effort to actually have our basin plans approved by the US EPA. I can just tell you that the strongest case against shellfish harvesting being assigned here is that it wasn't assigned appropriately. If the burden of proof is on us to demonstrate that it can never be achieved, we might have to go a step further and conduct more complete analyses. But the folks in the room up in
so shellfishing, I did a little bit of research on that issue because I believe the initial intent of the shellfish harvesting or the shell beneficial use was to protect for saltwater, but I think that's changed. But I was unable to get documentation that paper trail. But I think that changed in the mid 90s sometime.
One of the reasons the birds are there is because of crawdads. You know, there's a shellfish population if you want to include them. But we don't observe or we're not aware of any commercial scale, or I should say harvestable population of those. And but on the other hand, you know, the environment supports them on that ground. Mm-hmm. It doesn't support the more commonly harvested species of saltwater based shellfish or the freshwater. Initially we thought, well, it's possible, quite possible, that the mouth of the slough at Pajaro, where you saw that picture, is influenced substantially by marine water and could support shellfish population of mussels or possibly clams. And there is historic documentation of clamming on the beach side of Pajaro Dunes, but that's gone by the wayside decades ago. But even today, we don't even see mussels encrusting hard materials on that, in that little interface between the slough and the river. And I would have to say that's probably because the seasonality of closing and the freshwater influence is too great for them to sustain there, to be sustained there.
Shanta, did you happen to check with any of the wardens at Fish and Game?
Yes. Yes, I asked I can't remember the person I talked to off the top of my head, but at Fish and Game, I talked to quite a few people, and with each person I talked to, I think they talked to another person, and no one had heard of any shellfishing going on in the area.
Okay, but you had spoken to game wardens?
Yeah, I believe Larry Espinosa, I don't know if he's a game warden.
He's a biologist for Fish and Game.
Yeah, I'm sorry that my notes are upstairs. I just don't remember the gentleman's name off the top of my head, but there is a warden for that area that I did speak with that wasn't 100% that there's absolutely nothing occurring here, but he said in all the time that he's worked there, he did not remember any shellfishing harvesting going on. I wanted to add one thing to what Dominic said about the freshwater clams. I'm not positive if this is the same thing in Watsonville, but in some of the San Lorenzo River estuary, or San Lorenzo River and Soquel Lagoon, which is just north here of Watsonville, so I would assume has some similarities. The county of Santa Cruz told me that there are corbicula a couple miles upstream, but that most of them are really small, and they quoted me the size of a thumbnail. So if part of what we're trying to do with protecting shellfishing is to protect for human consumption, make sure everyone's okay, there's no problem with that, I think it would be really rare that someone would be able to make a meal out of these tiny clams as well. So I'm not, with Watsonville Slough, I have to say I'm not 100%.
There are people that do fish in those sloughs. And my question to you is that if you take that designation away, does that mean that there's a lesser requirements for that type of cleanup, which I would be opposed to if that's the case?
That is what it means. If you remove the shellfish harvesting beneficial use, the next most stringent water quality objective is associated with the non-contact recreational use.
And those sloughs empty into
contact.
The... Oh, okay. And I have a... I hope I can put this question out to you. It's probably quite lengthy. And if I can put it in the right order. My understanding that there has been a grant by the State Water Board for $500,000 for the South County, I'm talking about Gilroy, Morgan Hill, discharge to bring a pipeline from that area and San Benito County with sewage down to Harkin Slough or those combination sloughs for storage, and that the city of Watsonville is in the process of upgrading their sewage facilities, and they're going to also use one of those sloughs for storage, which will be used for agriculture. How does this all play together? And if that's the case, shouldn't there be a total EIR done to look at that? Because reading your staff report with all the pathogens and the contaminations in these particular sewers, and they're all interconnected. They're all interconnected, even somewhat over into the Elkhorn area. They're connected. Mm-hmm. I would have great concerns because that water would eventually get into the marine sanctuary in Monterey Bay. I know we're not talking about that per se, but in your report, it talks about the tributaries of Struve, Harkins, and also have a copy of a water Paro Valley Water Management District that they're talking about this pipeline and Struve Slough and the connecting sloughs for storage. And the information that I have from the farmers in the Paro Valley is that they're being told that this will be mixed to use on agricultural land. Is that it? Do you have any indication that this is going to happen?
I don't.
Well, it seems kind of coincidental we're doing the TMDL and all this is kind of coming together, and it seemed like a puzzle, and the puzzle seems to be going together.
Well, I have to say the TMDL was developed as its own puzzle, maybe. We didn't have any knowledge of these plans at the time of development. Of course, development of TMDL takes place over a few years, but if these are really new plans, that could explain it. But one thing you want to bear in mind is that the TMDL actually increases the, in a sense, the level of vigilance that we have on a water body by using water quality assurance that by adopting a TMDL here with very protective water quality objectives, we are in effect preparing for those kinds of proposals.
I understand that. I'm a big supporter of the TMDLs because I've always said that how can you measure what kind of discharge that you can allow in a tributary or a water body without knowing what the load is already.
Right.
And I was very happy to see that this is coming forth because that's a very sensitive area. As you mentioned, it's quite a bird sanctuary, mm-hmm. and it's a flyway for migratory birds as well as the Elkhorn area. They're all, like I said, is interconnected. But it just seems kind of ironic that, you can have this copy if you like,
yes.
That if they improve the water quality in those sloughs so much, the better. I would be a little concerned if what level of treated sewage water is being proposed to put in those sloughs.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, and if in Paro Valley agriculture surely needs the additional water, of course, to stop and install water intrusion. This all put it, it all fits together. Mm-hmm. And you can't just look at one piece of it. You have to look at the whole picture if this is what's actually going to happen. And it seemed like it's already on the works for some reason. I'm surprised that you were not aware of some of these things that are going on. But without prolonging all this, I still, my personal opinion, I would like to see the shellfish harvesting. As I said, I don't know if any, personally of it ever being a commercial. Mm-hmm. But I'd just like to have the water quality at a much higher level, mm-hmm. especially if they're going to use this on agricultural land somewhere in time with Watsonville and the South County discharging their, I wouldn't say influent, but treated wastewater into those bodies. Because it, I'd like to see them restored back to recreational fishing. They were at one time. Way back in the turn of the century.
Pardon me?
I'll be quiet for a minute and let you respond.
No, it's okay. I hope this sort of addresses your question, and if not, I'll hopefully speak a little clearer about this. I just wanted to point out that the definition of the shellfishing beneficial use is to protect for, among other things, human consumption, commercial or sport purposes. And so that's more to protect for you know, diseases that humans might get from eating the shellfish. What we are not proposing to de-designate with this water body is the beneficial use of commercial and sport shellfishing, which the definition is uses of water for commercial or recreational collection of fish, shellfish, or other organisms. So it's a little confusing, though, because commercial does not have a bacterial water quality objective associated with it, whereas the shellfishing beneficial use does. So we're not denying that fishing or collection maybe of the tiny clams might occur for bait purposes, but in terms of human consumption, we don't think that's occurring. And just in addition, I just also wanted to point out the very last paragraph of the use attainability analysis, but we do have in here that says,
harvested by recreational fishermen, mm-hmm. to be used. I don't know if they consume them themselves, mm-hmm. but I have used them for fishing. So that's my personal knowledge.
Mr. Jeffries, can I just confirm that you're stating that horseneck clams, to your knowledge, have been harvested in Watsonville Slough?
I can't say for sure that it was in Watsonville Slough. But in your staff report, it says the Watsonville Slough and its tributary, Struve, right. Hanson, Harkins, and so forth. I do know that horseneck clams came out of one of those sloughs.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. And I don't know which one, because the people that give me the, at that time were very secretive where they were getting their bait from. Mm-hmm. So they just don't, I mean, that's the fishing group.
Okay, I just want to be clear that all other sources of information and knowledge on that never came up. So it is a surprise to hear that. But
so what is the other? This is one beneficial use. There's one that's very similar. Mm-hmm. That also uses the word shell or shellfish in it. Can you put that up?
Yes, it does use the word shellfish in it. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last one. Do you have a
slide? Of which use is that? Commercial? Yeah.
This,
I don't have a commercial.
This is not the one that we are deleting, or it is?
This is the one.
This is.
Okay. Which is the one that's going to remain that's similar?
It's the commercial and sport fishing beneficial use. We don't have a slide for it, but Shanta just read it. I'll read it to you again. Okay. It's defined as uses of water for commercial or recreational collection of fish, shellfish, or other organisms. And right below that is the shellfish harvesting beneficial use in our basin plan that
so,
is stated.
So why wouldn't the fecal coliform standard remain if you have the other beneficial use designation remaining?
Our basin plan does not have a numeric fecal coliform objective associated with commercial that I know of. It's associated with shellfish and with recreation uses. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're going with an existing water quality objective, not just a use. Mm. If we wanted to perhaps be more thorough, we would propose that the commercial use be removed as well. But there's no need to do it in order to move the ball forward on the Tyndale, so to speak. I guess we would be in a position of having to develop a set of reasonable objectives, water quality objectives, or targets associated with commercial to then say these are inappropriate for this water body. Do you see what I'm saying?
Russ, I don't have a problem with what they're proposing for this reason. If staff assures me that they've spoken to the Fish and Game wardens and they have no history of finding people, you know, fishing without a sport fishing license, they're the ones that are out in the field looking for things. So if you have spoken with the Fish and Game enforcement side as opposed to the biologist, then I would feel comfortable about that. The other reason is this just affects the coliform standard, and that typically wouldn't affect the harvesting of fin fish. That might be it.
Oh, that's true.
And while you're looking for that, I just wanted to point out that the definition of commercial and sport fishing specifically refers to bait, but the shell fishing use does not. It does say human consumption, recreational, or sport fishing, but it doesn't specifically say bait. So if that's the only use, I think that's a significant distinction.
You say it's page 2 of the...
Which attachment?
Yeah.
That's a state one.
Attachment 2.
Yeah, we don't have a copy of that.
Yeah.
Where's shell? Is it in alphabetical order? Where's shell?
So that's...
How come it looks different in Dominic's report?
They're trying to get away from having the stricter equal coliform standard apply in those waters.
I like
the protection.
Is that correct, Lori?
But I'll tell you, with all those birds
around,
it would be... A nightmare.
It says human consumption. I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't usually.
Well, it doesn't in your report. It doesn't on page 2.
Dr. Hunter.
Isn't for shellfish harvesting, wouldn't the Department of Health Services monitor any commercial take?
Yeah. There is none. Well, they would monitor if there's any commercial shellfish farming going on.
Farming.
Yeah, there are no commercial shellfish farms in that area.
Okay.
The Fish and Game would monitor.
But I would think any commercial, if there were any commercial activity going on in the future, what I'm asking is, aren't there Department of Health Services standards that have to be met for commercial harvest, regardless of farming or as long as it's being harvested at a commercial scale? So, again, I think we're looking at some overlap between water quality limits that we'd like to see and understanding that the Department of Health Services also has an interest in monitoring and assuring that anything that's harvested commercially would be looked at for health impacts.
Comment?
Could I ask you to maybe state it once more to be clear? Sorry. State your question once again.
Oh, no, I didn't have a question.
Just
I was
a comment.
Just commenting that we could rely also on Department of Health Services' responsibility for oversight of commercial harvested.
That is the strategy we've used where we've left in place the shellfish harvesting use. That the case of Morro Bay, where we were in a position of designing a numeric target that was actually more appropriate than what our basin plan uses. And Shanta actually was the author of that approach as well. And she, as I recall, she used the Department of Health Services standards, not our basin plan standards, because they are more up to date.
At this juncture, you know, I can talk to you about it later, about what Health Services does and what they don't do, and how much we could rely upon Health Services or Fish and Game in this area. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, any other board comments or does staff have anything else to add to this? We do have a card. Should we go to our speaker?
Yeah.
Lisa, is that okay?
Yes.
Should we go to our speaker? Okay. Darlene Din, Santa Cruz Farm Bureau. So there is a shellfish farmer, right, that we don't know about. No? Not even funny, huh?
But, you know, if there was money to be made in it, we would do it.
Darlene Din, Santa Cruz County Farm Bureau, thank you for being able to address you on this item. I wanted to change the topic a little bit to manure. I think it's important that you have a clarification of language of applied manure. Applied manure may mean one thing to a regulated class, and composting means a different issue. And I think the language has to be very clear on what the intent is, and the use of the word of just manure.
Do you have a suggestion on a wording change? That
my understanding is that there has been documentation submitted to staff, and it was used up here in the slide presentation, and I'm not sure if the actual resolution was changed, and I'd like a clarification on that.
Okay.
And the second point is just on items such as this, if at all possible for a scheduling purpose, it would be really appreciated if they could be heard in the Watsonville, Salinas, or farther north, just because of the constraints of driving down for these items. I mean, it's just helpful whenever possible. And that's just a general jurisdictional issue because Pajaro's TMDL was heard here. And now Watsonville SLU is being heard here. And it's just helpful for...
I think we agree with that. Yeah.
When you can.
Sure.
And that is just a general request on behalf of Santa Cruz. And then the third item is the use of maybe internally looking at the TAC approach and outreach and how we would do that in the future. Not necessarily a complaint, just to maybe put some form of thought into that as we start moving through the TMDL process, how that will be approached and with the public and with the regulated class and with the different stakeholders in the group. And then I'd like to comment on Mr. Jeffrey's comments as it relates to the BMP on the Pajaro Valley Management. I sit in those meetings and I participate as a stakeholder for the Farm Bureau, and I don't believe that it's really relevant to the TMD process. The treatment plant and will go to a tertiary. The right now, unless the pipeline is approved, the city will be looking at wells and participatory right on site at the treatment plant, and that was approved by the Coastal Commission and the City of Watsonville. And that's been ongoing, and as we look at agricultural uses and water, the issues of water quality and the TDS rate and how that water's delivered and the blend rate is very important. In fact, today we'll be leaving to go directly to the grower meeting at the Pajaro Valley Water Management Agency that's dealing with this delivered water and the TDS levels and the next stage of the bid allocations for construction of this project. So it's highly screened by the public, and there is a lot of material. And you could reach that through the internet. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning, John.
Do you have any concerns about the livestock prohibition?
Yes.
Would you like to address that?
Yes. The concerns that I have been looking at that area, and that's been a root of quite a bit of the conversation, and that has to do with the manure and the application of livestock and also the management. That's another reason why I am really requesting that the public outreach and the evaluation on this and how we go through this process, because it's a kind of a quick response to one segment of a solution instead of a more overview to where it is. And our basic concern all along on this has been that we won't be able to meet these standards anyways because of the natural issues related in the bird population and some of the natural that we're starting off. Staff made, as you'll see in your report, quite a few comments to the issues that were raised by the city, which is the urban user, the agricultural entities, the county, and we probably wouldn't recommend that, and that is of a concern. We've done correspondence on that, staff's response, and it is a concern. Thank you.
Can I just ask you a question? In the Parle Valley water management bulletin they put out, they talk about the Harkin Slough project.
Yes.
Is this where the tertiary-treated water from the Watsonville plant's going to be discharged to?
No. It's a separate standalone project. That's part of the overall basin management plan, and it's part of the calculations for the overall water needed to distribute on the coast to stop the pumping of water. And
yeah, salt water. It's similar to what they use in the Castorville. Is that
very
is that
what it actually it
modeling the Parle Valley is being modeled after the Castorville project?
And everything that they've done right, it's in the Parle Valley, and the things that the growers felt could have been improved in have all been brought into this. And most, quite a few of the users farm both areas geographically and are active in both the Castorville CSIP project and the Parle Valley project.
Where is the water going? How is it going to be delivered to the farmers from the Watsonville treatment? I know this is not part of the TMDL, but it's still talking about Harkin Slough.
What will happen is the treatment plant that's being developed will be right next to the wastewater plant. And that is going to be a new process. It's done to a gold lead standard. I mean, so that's to this because there's an actual delivery system right out of the treatment plant. The blending will be done in the treatment plant, and it's not necessarily. It appears because there's multiple projects going on, it looks like it's involved in the slough, but those are standalone projects.
Okay. And during the wet part of the year, where will that water go to be discharged?
The Marine Sanctuary in their normal city discharge permit.
Thank you.
Ms. Dinn?
Yes.
Did the Farm Bureau participate in any of the workshops?
One of their representatives did, not myself. I do more public policy. The person that handles the technical aspects was participatory in the comments, and there is a letter that she wrote that is included and was received by your staff.
Mm-hmm. Dominic, I see we had 3 workshops conducted. Were any up
That's
in
correct.
The Watsonville area?
They were all up there.
They were all
yeah.
up there. Okay.
Thank you.
Right. I wanted to just check. You said that there was information that you sent us or in the last
Santa Cruz County Farm Bureau had sent you?
No, when you first started about the manure issue.
My understanding is that you have received correspondence from technical people as it relates to the manure language. I've not written it, but
I don't know.
I'll verify that because
yeah,
I have it. So I've
had some conversations with Kay Mercer and the people in the Watsonville area who have, in effect, been the people who witnessed the spreading of manure, but no one regarding the whole issue of manure. On a technical basis, and you're absolutely right. It's a broad term, and it's not meant to cover all the bioadditives, which are injected directly into the irrigation stream and include predominantly sterile sources of nutrients. So we don't mean to capture all that. It could be that we need a change in the wording, but the term manure is meant to be to apply to the raw material here. So.
Thank you.
Right. And we believe it happens. We know it happens. And there are actually very straightforward processes to determining whether the material has been composted to an adequate degree. And
what do you think you need to put a couple of qualifying words in there? Because the next staff person that may deal with this in 4 or 5 years
mm-hmm.
may not have. What's that?
Kay is here. Would you like to?
When I read the prohibition, I was confused. I'm sorry, Kay Mercer with the Santa Barbara County Ag Watershed Coalition. And when I read the, and I have nothing to do with Watsonville SLU except interest in the prohibition process. So I read the prohibition, and that was one of the comments that I had for Dominic, was the term manure by itself was misleading. Are they referring to raw manure, which was just now clarified that, yes, that's what they're referring to, or were they referring to treated manure, which would be composted? So if they are referring to raw manure, it should say raw manure probably, and if they are referring to any other kind of bioadditive, that should be clarified as well. Otherwise, growers will think it doesn't apply to them.
Okay.
And so that's my
operations. I'm looking at Table 9-3 in Attachment 2 in the report, and there's a really long list of costs associated with managing on-site practices for rangeland, and I'm just wondering, are we looking at a large number of operators in that area? Do you have some idea?
It's very small. In fact, the red flag on grazing came up early in the development of this TMDL during the assessment period of source analysis. There was a large landholding on Hanson Slough, mm-hmm. which had nibbled it down to the nub. I guess it was a feedlot, in effect, and there was serious sedimentation problems and a presumed fecal material. During the TMDL, that operator moved on, and the primary impetus for addressing grazing directly in the TMDL, in effect, was lost, but there do remain smaller operations. There's emu grazing, if you will, and we believe there are, of course, ample amounts of horse paddocks and that kind of grazing that aren't solely amendment fed. But in general, it's a small number, and the operations are small.
So achieving a complete prohibition on discharge is doable following these kinds of improvements, and I'm looking at things like fencing and buffers and different kinds of revegetation. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've worked in, before I came to the water board, I worked with some horse owners in Marin County, and many of the issues that they face are just very direct containment, covering the storage area, shoveling up the manure in the paddock. Those kinds of practices really take care of almost all of the problem, and what remains are insignificant quantities. There are some places, though, in Larkin Valley where the stream itself is contiguous with a paddock. Mm. And so we're attempting to address those with some of these more, again, we aren't prescribing these, but these are the kinds of measures that could be used to address those. Those might include fencing, buffers, vegetated buffers and swales. But typically, when you're addressing the transport of manure from a livestock facility, covering the manure storage area is number one and takes care of a huge portion of the problem. But
good, thank you.
And I do have confidence we will address it through these measures.
And then monitoring, is this a new, in terms of these operators developing a monitoring plan, is this something new, or is this something they've had to do in the past?
This is new.
So what kind of models do we have for them?
We don't have many, actually. The non-point source implementation policy, enforcement policy of the state, has set forth a five-element plan called a non-point source implementation. Another watershed, the Pajaro, the board recently adopted a prohibition in December on sediment discharges from some of these same kinds of operations. And we expect the Pajaro and the Watsonville examples to allow us to, in effect, develop kind of innovative approaches to these feedback mechanisms. I hesitate to use the word monitoring because in many respects, what we're going to get doesn't deserve that term. It's more of a an approach to tracking the effectiveness. But we ultimately have to be able to say at the end of the day, is water quality better off? But in some cases, it might be photographic evidence. It might be the manifest from the composter saying sterile. Manure is sterile, or it might be another piece of evidence.
So
we don't know exactly.
So the link between monitoring receiving waters is not necessarily the responsibility of the individual livestock operators. I guess that's what I was trying to clear up, is
right.
how much of that effort will fall to the right. smaller operators.
There's a choice they have, and that is to focus on their own site and develop evidence and possibly including water quality data to support their assertions that they're not contributing, or to collectively work with neighboring operators and monitor the receiving water. And I think most of them are going to prefer to stick to their facility. And what we will find out through our own ambient monitoring and through the monitoring conducted by the city and county, we will have ambient monitoring data from the receiving waters to kind of check on the effectiveness. It won't be straightforward. It won't be easy. It's a iterative process, and I think through the ag waiver, you're familiar with the concept of drilling down through the different layers. But it's a similar process here on a smaller scale, probably somewhat more simplistic once you get it down to the local level.
And since you mentioned the ag water quality, really quickly, I noticed the comment made that the monitoring program that's designed for ag water quality currently doesn't monitor for pathogens. So what kind of coordination do you envision for that to facilitate that? Because I think this is an important goal, but it's coming at a time when there's a tremendous right. Effort, and I think very complicated effort, to get monitoring underway. So how do you envision that working into that process?
Well, at this point, it is an open question. We've had initial internal discussions and kind of brief interaction with the agricultural stakeholders on how this might take place, but we don't have a direct plan yet. We recognize that some of the best solutions come from the regulated community, and they certainly have a keen awareness of the issue and are already mobilizing, it sounds like, on certain issues. For example, the manure issue has become a sort of a technical problem to solve, both for that community and for the water board. So what I'm anticipating, and this is somewhat speculative, but of innovative approaches working with us, we have not at this time allocated staff time or directed staff to that process, but we recognize it's an inevitability that we'll need to meet them mm-hmm. halfway.
Thank you. I appreciate the explanation.
Any other board questions or comments? Okay. Mr. Briggs?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. This will be a quick one. I'm sorry. Chairman, I just wanted to make a clarification. I wanted to check through my notes. You had said as long as staff assured you that I had spoken with the warden, you would be okay with it. And I wanted to check my notes because I wrote this over a year ago, and I've done two since then in which I did speak with the warden. But I just wanted to check. I checked my notes, and I spoke with four different people at the Department of Fish and Game, one of them being a biologist who said he would talk to other wardens, and if they found anything out, that he would give me a call. And so I just wanted to make sure I wasn't telling you an untruth. So I didn't speak with the wardens directly, even though I spoke with four other people. I spoke with somebody who said he would get in touch with the wardens, and if there was anything contrary to what he had told me, he would get back to me. So I'm sorry. My recollection from a year ago wasn't completely clear. So I wanted to clarify
that. And he never got back to you?
No. Not to my knowledge. I might have been gone on maternity leave, but it would have said to contact Dominic. So, yeah. So.
Was that biologist Larry Espinosa?
Let's see. The person who said he would talk to... No, it was Dave Johnston. But I did speak with Larry Espinosa, and I did speak with Steve Schindler and also Terry Palmisano. I spoke with all four of them directly. So I just wanted to clarify because I didn't want to make an untruth.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Briggs.
So, you want to summarize the changes? I know we have one word plus a supplemental sheet.
That's correct. The supplemental sheet includes some reworking of the language of the resolution, and we're prepared to make that into the final document. And then throughout the documents, or the resolution, we will insert the word raw before the word manure, where it occurs.
Mr. Chair, can I have that clarified? Because raw may mean one thing to one person, but it may mean another thing to another person.
And did you say non-sterile?
Yeah, non-sterile. That would, or processed, or
I don't know.
We could do that.
Because you could have a farmer that would pile manure and say, geez, that wasn't raw. It was just, I had it piled up there. It's been for 2 or 3 years. And
like non-sterile
right.
Better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds good to me.
I think it'd be less confusing that way anyway.
Okay.
That's
it. We have a recommendation before us.
Move the staff recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Shallcross. We have a second. Dr. Bowker, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay.
Is that for all three?
That was for all three
okay.
Components of the staff recommendation.
It's all in the resolution.
Just checking.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Resolution.
Meeting dates. Yeah, skip Santa Barbara. No. I just think we could take one of our San Luis take one of our San Luis Obispo meetings and just have the third one up there and until the workload seems to drop off.
The board sets the schedule, so we can draft it that way the next time it comes around the horn.
We'll do.
Lisa.
Thank you. Before you move on, I just would like to publicly recognize the contributions that Dominic Rock has made to the TMDL program here at Region 3, as well as on a certain level, at state level as well, and specifically to determining some really critical improvement strategies in many of our water bodies. And on our side, we're disappointed that he won't be continuing to do that work, but I know he's going to continue to do great things for the other programs and for water quality improvement. So thanks, Dominic.
Well, he is staying in Region 3, right?
This yes.
Is okay.
Yes, he is.
You guys have an oblique way of communicating with us.
Yeah, it's just I've taken the assignments of the 401 certification program, and I did that a few months ago. And so this just because it was on my plate, I can continue the item forward to the conclusion.
Is this a voluntary?
Absolutely.
It is. Okay.
You'll hear from me again. Don't worry. Thank
good.
You.
All right.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, if we could move to item 16, skip over 14 for the moment.
Okay.
Item 16 is the State Revolving Fund Project Priority List, and that was on the consent calendar, but we had a card, and I just thought we should get that in before we break for lunch. So we'll just go straight to the comment.
Okay. Mr. Greening, would you like to comment on this item, number 16?
Thank you. Eric Greening, yes, and this is the revolving loans. I had a couple of questions about the way things were listed. On attachment number one, the fifth from the bottom, I'm not familiar with a South San Luis Obispo CSD, and I'm wondering what entity we're talking about here. And then the other issue I have, obviously the final decision on item 9 has been continued to the month of May. The project description on page 2 near the bottom of the first column where it gives construction dates, and then on attachment 1 where it says upgrade to full secondary, second line from the bottom. I would just like to hear some reassurance that those project descriptions are not in any way presupposing an outcome of the hearing on what was item number 9 today when it happens, that it may end up being a tertiary project and it may end up happening sooner. So I just wanted to make sure before you adopted this that you were not presupposing anything in relation to that item. Thank you.
Okay. Comment from staff? Okay.
Well, on the fifth from the bottom, that's the South County Sanitation District.
Oh, thank you.
Is that correct, Harvey?
Yeah.
So it's a CSD, a South County Sanitation District is what that's supposed to mean.
All right, okay. That concludes.
I don't know the details. We have to look it up.
Can I get some information on that?
Sure.
Are these the ones that we're proposing? This is a priority list being
right.
sent to the state board for possible funding?
Everyone on the list except the bottom two are already on the state board list.
For funding?
For funding, yeah.
Doesn't mean they're going to get funding.
I'm not sure. Not necessarily. They're on the priority list.
Okay.
Some of them are future projects to be proposed, and that's where Morro Bay would be. It's a placeholder to get them on the list
okay.
for future funding.
Can I get some information on that item?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And I suggest we break for lunch. We're hoping to actually get out of here about 11:45.
Okay.
And come back. What do we think about one? Shoot for 1:20 or something like that.
Do we want to act on this item first?
Oh, I'm sorry. details. Yeah, we do need a motion.
Move approval. Or
adopt the list. So we do need a motion?
To adopt a list?
Yes.
So move.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Unanimous.
Okay.
All right. Now we will return at 1:20.
We'll shoot for that.
Are we having a closed session?
Lori, are we having a closed session?
Yes.
Before we go or when we
No, when we come back.
When
okay.
we come back.
Okay.
There we go. We've got power. At least my light is on.
Okay.
Okay, folks, we're going to begin. And we are going to start this afternoon with our public forum. Everybody will have 3 minutes to address the board on any issues not on the agenda. First speaker is David Broadwater, followed by Joey Roccano, followed by Richard Sadowski.
That's great. Go.
Fire away.
My name is David Broadwater. I'm from Atascadero, and I'm here to talk about this project that's up on the map. Here, that's a 5-acre parcel up in San Miguel Times background. And on the 9th of this month, the Planning Commission decided to send the project back to the drawing board, and they may be working to get more soil sampling done on there and a better site characterization. The project also states the county's staff report that because the drainage is so poor here that they're going to have to build some kind of way to facilitate drainage off the site. I don't know where that will occur. But I also understand from the county that your board, the Regional Water Board, sent in a response as part of their CEQA review of this project that indicated apparently, I haven't seen your letter, or response yet that you didn't have any problem with this project. Problem is that there isn't much known other than this 1 5-foot sample at 24 parts per million. And there are other problems on this property: railroad ties, creosote, railroad spur ran across this property on a diagonal, plus some off-site over into this area, apparently, underground storage tank, which led to some soil and groundwater contamination. So I don't know if your board saw or staff saw the Phase 1 environmental site assessment and the Phase 2 environmental assessment, plus another report by Cuesta Geotechnical on this, but I would encourage your board to get access from the county to the environmental site assessments that have been done, you know, up to this point, and contact them to find out if there are concerns that you might have about potential surface and groundwater contamination because of what was found there. I've distributed a letter. I didn't have copies for every member of the board that I sent to the county departments for your information, and I can send more to you by email if you need to have more copies of that. Mm-hmm. But that's basically the situation, and I would encourage your board to perhaps get access to more information that you may not have had at the time that you or your staff did the review on this project. We don't know if the 24 part per million is the highest concentration that's on this property, the lowest, the average. It's just one sample that's been taken at this point. So,
Mr. Broadwater, this is something that has not come to the board itself, to the board, to the board members.
I'm trying to find out, and I don't know yet.
And so this is the first time we are hearing about it. Staff knows about it.
Okay.
So perhaps Mr. Briggs could address.
Well, actually, I think the only way we know about it is through the newspaper stories. Mr. Broadwater called me yesterday about this issue, and so in the meantime, I asked Harvey Packard to check on it. We couldn't come up with a letter that you were referencing yet. Chris Adair, do you know about such a letter? If the answer is no, then that's...
The answer is no.
Okay. So we'll have to look a little bit further, but I think the main thing is that my understanding is that this issue of the soil contamination actually probably came up after, if we commented on the negative deck or whatever. So I think the main thing now would be, as you suggest, for us to touch bases with the county. So we'll do that.
Take your offer ahead there.
All right, Joey Ricano.
Honorable Board, I actually have a... Yes, sir. And 8. Okay. By and large, I'm just here to talk about water quality with you. I want to I'm Joey Ricano, Ocean Outfall Group. In all seriousness, want to thank you for your bold leadership on water quality issues right now. I think that the time has come for us to all be working together because the Central Coast's water quality is under siege, and you are our line of defense. I like the idea of what I read today in the paper about you standing up against a change in standards for San Luis Obispo's Creek. I think that's a step backwards as well. I want you to know that in Los Osos, I've been attending a lot of the committee meetings, and I want you to know that the people there take the cease and desist orders very seriously. I think you'd be very impressed with the way the people have solidified and are moving forward, and so I ask you to deal with that situation in an even-handed fashion. As far as Morro Bay Cayucas' wastewater treatment plant upgrade, I think that we need to remember something when we give them a 9.5-year timeline. You would be giving them that timeline to come into compliance with the full secondary standards of 33 years ago. That's a problem. 9.5 years from now, secondary standards would be 42.5 years overdue, and by then we'd need to be going full tertiary. So the main thing I'm asking you about that is, please, shorter timeline, full tertiary treatment. It's what makes sense. Another thing that's interesting is I wanted to touch on the fact that in Orange County, where we fought the Orange County Sanitation District's 301H waiver, they are doing a similar timeline on a project 120 times larger. And then there's the idea of otter mortality and how it pertains to the outfall of Morro Bay. Basically, I think it's the weakened immune systems of the otters that are causing them to be more prone to toxoplasmosis. And then finally, there's the dangerous shortcut that Morro Bay Cayucas has been taking by trying to disinfect less than fully secondarily treated sewage. Now, because of that low level of treatment, you have larger organic molecules. And so the chlorine or whatever you use to disinfect tends to just coat the outside of these molecules. This is a process called encapsulation. We ran into it in Orange County. It leaves live pathogens inside. And then there's the big problem that these chemicals react with the carbon and they form organochlorines, which are endocrine disruptors that wreak havoc with the...
Richard Sadowski?
Richard Sadowski. We're Cougars.
Followed by, excuse me, Marla Jo Bruton, and then Keith Swanson.
Okay.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Richard Sadowski, Central Coast Ocean Outfall Group, or known as the Cougars. I'm also a grade 4 collection system operator from the California Water Environment Association. I would like to thank this board for postponing agenda item 9. Because of the erroneous data that was presented by Robert Enns, Bill Boucher, and Frank Cunningham with regards to the sewer study. We cannot talk about the treatment plant until you talk about the collection system, because the collection system, everything goes to the treatment plant. And the situation at Morro Bay and Cayucas, what we have here is a plan was proposed to the elected officials there at Morro Bay, and the Cougars' position on the treatment plan has always been 5 years full tertiary, and in 3 years you should be able to get that plant built and then have 2 years to check it out. Now, I have about 25 years experience in facilities engineering and test ops engineering, and I know there's a lot of bureaucracy involved. I dealt with it with the Department of Defense when I worked for the National Security Council launching satellites. So it could be done. You know, when I worked in Vandenberg, there was a plan to build and launch satellites that they gave us 3 years to do it. We did it in a year and a half. If you have the proper people, and if we get good people to work on it, like local union help or something, we can get this job done. And our position is full tertiary, 5 years. I think that's fair. That's really doable. And accurate sewer studies. We need to get accurate data. And right now, Wallace Engineering, who was doing the sewer study, and Steve Tanaka, they don't have the accurate information. We need to get that accurate information, and we need to have you presented with good data before you can make a decision. And the Cougars do support this board. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Jo Bruton.
Marla, pardon me.
Marla, good afternoon. First, I just want to, I have your agenda here, and on the web it said that the issue number 9, the Morro Bay Cayucas wastewater treatment plant is...
off calendar.
Off calendar, that's
right.
True? That's
yes,
correct?
That's
okay,
true.
Good. Thank you. I'm glad to see that. I'm here for the Ocean Outfall Group, and we are pretty adamant about full tertiary from that plant and a shorter timeline. The footprint of the plant has actually is more suited to tertiary. Tertiary upgrade takes less of a footprint than the secondary. And seeing that by the time we get this finished, tertiary probably will become the new minimum, it just makes good sense. And I know the Morro Bay City Council, the mayor and the city council, have all, and the internal memo said, the State Water Board wants to help Los Osos clean its groundwater. The board intends to protect Morro Bay from sewage. And
I don't think we've seen that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Bear with me the premise that if that were true, if the State Board wanted to help clean up the groundwater in Los Osos, and if the State Board intended to protect Morro Bay from sewage, if you look at this as a holistic approach to the Estero Bay, the tertiary upgrade makes sense. And then we'd have ag water exchange that would come along with this. And in Los Osos, the pumping of the septic tanks, it would be exasperating. Let's see where I'm going here. Let's see, that would exasperate the aquifer, depletion of the upper aquifer. And where'd I go here? That's it. Anyway, that's up my time. Sorry.
One thing, let me just comment. And Mr. Sadowski and Mr. Rocano commented on this. The law does not require tertiary treatment.
I know that.
You know, yeah. Unless there's a component that is getting through secondary treatment.
Excuse me. This relates to a matter that's pending before the board. It's not on this agenda, but it will be on a future agenda, and I don't think it's appropriate for the board to engage in discussions about a pending permit application outside of the hearing on that application.
Okay. My tongue is tied.
Okay. Well, thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your comments.
Good afternoon, Keith Swanson, Los Osos. Just wanted to comment on the actions of this board and by staff against Los Osos. I believe it was premature to act against Los Osos. I don't think that the new board that was elected by this community had any intentions of not building a project. They were just changed the project because the people voted and rejected $205 a month, at least a month, to flush your toilet. Oceano is having problems with their community now at $15 a month for a water treatment plant, and that's going to escalate. And they're upset, and they're concerned about people who will not be able to afford it and have to move for $15 a month. We're faced with $205 a month. I think it's unfair that you're doing what you're doing against the Los Osos CSD. You allowed the old board and the old project 2 years to construct a wastewater treatment plant and no CDOs. And now that this project is stopped and another one is in the works, all of a sudden you're going to go ahead and throw away that grace period and implement something against the community now. It doesn't make any sense. You've already given them 2 years. Why? After 2 years, then I can see where you have a reason to do that. The LLCSD is also trying for legislation for septic management, which was something that you had in 8312, 8313. And it's always been encouraged by this board, but never done by the county or the old CSD. But this CSD board is doing that now. Allowing building from 1983 to 1988 in Los Osos to the new project when they took it from the county. So it's just unfortunate, and I think that, you know, the citizens, the community wants to conserve water. They want to do everything they can to get a wastewater project in Los Osos. But what you're doing is not helping us. Thank you.
I have a lot to say about that, but I know that I will be kept from doing so, and you'll just have to hear what I have to say at some other time. Well, thank you, Mr. Swanson. Okay, Mr. Valesky, David Dugan, and then Lindy Owen.
Members of the board, it's a pleasure to be here in front of you today. I just wanted to bring you some good news from Los Osos, and haven't had much time.
It's about time.
Yeah, well, it's going to take a little bit more to get the great news, but we're working in that direction. Just wanted to give you kind of an update on the progress that the LOCSD is moving forward on. We are currently, as of last night, we made a selection and final negotiations with Dana Ripley for the updating of the project report. We also are negotiating with another consultant that I believe that is well known in this area to take a look at our septic management program. We're evaluating also on our septic management program if we do need special legislation. I think in the past that legislation may have been required if we were looking at a franchise for that. We're no longer considering that. We're looking at possibly using contracts under our auspices and our charter to provide those pumping services or the evaluation inspection services. So that effort's going on. That's the next step that we're doing. We also are looking at cleaning up the ACL sites. We have Piranha coming on board to demonstrate one of their systems that's been perfected a little bit more over the last 4 years at the fire station. We have one leach field and one tank that we can modify to see if that's going to give us the results that meet the basin plan. And we'll report back to staff who we've been working with and trying to improve our communications with. We're moving a little bit too quick, and I don't think our communications are keeping up. The other thing we're looking at is to reduce nitrates at the Vista de Aro site and the Bay Ridge Estate site by evaluating technologies. We're going to be bringing that consultant on to take a look at that. Our objective on all of these efforts is to parallel them with keeping a project moving forward, and we're hoping to have a project report by August 4th. The other two activities are parallel with that so that we don't stretch this thing out and complement the main project report effort. Our objectives are twofold. One is to do anything to reduce nitrate discharges into the basin, period. If we would have been doing that years ago in small forms, well, we can discuss that later, and that's not why I'm here. But that's our objective, is to take a little bite out of it as quickly as we can and then to build on that. The other thing is our objective is to establish a revenue stream, and that revenue stream benefits everyone. That benefits Los Osos.
I once said that the ACL action against the LOCSD was politically motivated. I also have stated that the CDOs were also politically motivated action. Since I have no proof of these actions, that these actions were politically motivated, I will withdraw my supposition. I would also like to point out that when some people speak of actions by the Regional Water Quality Control Board, their comments on most occasions should be directed towards the actions of the staff and not the board. However, that being said, if you look closely at the actions, words, and timing of actions by staff and this board, you could assume some actions and communications could be timed and worded to affect political decisions being made by the community of Los Osos. History. I have been reviewing the history of Los Osos wastewater issue, specifically actions by this board and the State Water Resource Control Board concerning the SRF loans and the CDOs issued in response to delays and the political activities of the County of SLO, San Luis Obispo, and the community of Los Osos, and some very interesting facts have surfaced. Without getting into detail, this board and the State Board have been very forgiving of San Luis Obispo County and the previous LOCSD boards from its inception until now. At various stages through the history of these issues, this board and staff have gone out of their way to accommodate both San Luis Obispo County and the LOCSD so compliance could be achieved. In 1999, the newly formed LOCSD was allowed to abandon the county's fully funded and permitted project in hopes that a cheaper, better, faster project could be realized. These were political decisions made by the community of Los Osos and the LOCSD, and they were given time to explore options without penalty. Those options or alternatives were not fully explored, nor were they presented to this board. However, this current LOCSD is being treated differently. Why? Is it because you are frustrated? No doubt. Is it because it's your duty? I suggest that you should have acted in 1999 or before according to code. Regardless of your actions or inactions, the current LLCSD will be presenting alternatives to this agency in due time. I would ask that you give them fair review without prejudice or malice. Only through communication and cooperation will our common goal of compliance will be realized. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Ms. Owen, followed by Joyce Albright, and then there's no name on this card. It just says CDO, recipient, homeowner. Is there someone here that forgot to put their name in? 1272 4th Street? Okay. All right. You'll be the third person then. And then you can tell us who you are at that time. Ms. Owen?
Good afternoon. Lindy Owen, homeowner in the Prohibition Zone of Los Osos. I come to speak to you today because I would like to address the concern that I see of the cease and desist order actions that are 45 homeowners have been to Santa Maria, which is the closest facility that we know of. It could go even further. The estimated amount of waste haulage per household per year is 9,000 gallons. Six haulings times 5,000 households and 120 round-trip miles to Santa Maria, not including the pump-out pollution and idle time of dumping that pollution, equals 3.6 million diesel truck miles per year added to the San Luis Obispo airshed. According to statistics from the Atmospheric Deposition Handbook for Watershed Managers, Office of Wetlands, Oceans, Watersheds, U.S. Environmental EPA, they conclude that most of this nitrate pollution does end up in waterways and eventually in the ocean. So what this really means is that for every pound of nitrogen you are hauling, you are dumping 5 pounds back into the bay. And thirdly, the amount we are in saltwater intrusion, we are looking to find a sewer that will help us recycle our water so that we can do our build out and have adequate water without importing. For tank pumping, the quantity of water removed from the hydrologic cycle of Estero Bay and removed from recharge is 9,000 gallons a year times 5,000 households equals 45 million gallons that you'll be removing from our water basins. That is not going to work very well for us. This is all expected. I mean, we have been told that it will be in the next year, that during this year, that you would put those cease and desist orders on every household. I believe that we will be in litigation for years, and there will be lost money on both sides. And I would much rather see you help us with a septic management program. We're beginning the education end of it now, and we are looking into setting up an official management program, and that would be the best effective way until we do get our sewer plans introduced to you. Thank you.
Ms. Owen, we'll be able to talk about this issue, you know, at the April 28th meeting, when I'm sure we're going to have a full-blown discussion about most things that you've just mentioned. So I'm not.
In the meanwhile, you have 45 people that are scared to death, and we're now having to go out and raise funds to get lawyers to begin to battle this. I'm just saying that I would like you to consider that it may not be a productive use of any of our time.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Ms. Albright.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chairman and Board. I am Joyce Albright of Los Osos Taxpayers Watch. On February 16th, we submitted to LAFCO our dissolution petition signed by 2,034 residents, more than double the number of signatures required to qualify, and gathered in less than 3 weeks. So far, the additional signatures of Los Osos residents who had not previously signed and of out-of-town property owners has reached over 1,200. That brings the total to date of those supporting the dissolution to over 3,200 and growing. The community is clearly behind this process. Recently, disgraced purported sewer expert Gail McPherson publicly threatened Shirley Bianchi with a grand jury investigation. This from a woman who was sued by her past employer, settled for $40,000. Had the community's best interests at heart, it would relinquish responsibility for the sewer to the county, and we'd get on to it. We have a sewer, and we want to build it. If we can just dissolve this current board of incompetents who are bleeding our community dry. Their 2005 report shows a reduction of $4 million in 3 months. Where did that money go? Maybe part is the $50,000 a month paid to Blesky, plus to their attorneys. And the money continues to be siphoned off. This seems to be a race to see if they can strip the LOCSD of all of its assets before the dissolution becomes final. LAFCO has now become well aware of this gross incompetence and mismanagement, and we have confidence that it will decide in June to dissolve this corrupt board, which appears intent on making it impossible for a sewer to be built in our town. Then Los Osos will resurrect our recently suspended state-of-the-art sewer, whose location is the most appropriate choice. Thank you all for your continuing patience and fortitude.
Thank you, Ms. Albright. That was timed perfectly. And your name, sir?
My name is Dick Sargent, and I'm from Los Osos.
Okay.
Surprised, I
Mr.
forgot.
Sargent, okay.
This happens with the ears. Take care of the details. Let somebody else take care of the details. Anyway, I'm here to support you folks. I'm here to encourage you to fulfill your responsibility. I think it's very important our water is protected. It seems like that these people are engaging. I like them, but they're just misguided. That's my opinion. And I'm struggling. I'm struggling in a garage conversion worth probably $500,000, so I'm just barely getting by. And that is pretty typical of a lot of the folks. It's pretty easy to say it's expensive, $200 a month. But you figure that out. Let's see. At $200 a month, the original plan, which is the last one everybody talks about, for 12 months, that's $2,400. For 10 years, that's $24,000. For 20 years, that's $48,000. That's the price. Over a 20-year period of people spending, they spend on their cars. And they call this a bad deal. This is the best deal going. It's about 10% of the average value of the property. If you go back and you trace by percentages, this is a better percent than any program offered in the past. So I'm just saying, I have a sort of a checkered career, and I can sort of smell certain things in my misspent possibly past. I ended up, for some unknown reason, as expediters, production, sales, design, construction. It seems like every time I got into a job, I looked at things and I said, there's something wrong here, and for some reason they listened to me. I'm hoping you're listening to me now, because at the root of what I'm saying is to do what you're planning to do. By the way, I'm also a cease and desist order. Desist order, a person, a recipient. Doing what you're going to do to me is expediting, and that's where I come from. And you're faced
to May 25th, so you are in good time in terms of a response that might be able to make that staff report. On May 25th, they realize they may be deciding to take action, or they may be deciding on another continuance, depending on the level of site characterization that they feel is appropriate at that point. The project at this time has a proposed negative declaration, and on hazardous materials, the mitigation is deferred. And obviously, I've questioned that because not knowing the extent of the cleanup that will be necessary, we don't know whether the secondary impacts of this project could be of a level of significance to require an EIR. But I'm very, very glad to see you getting involved in this. And I recognize that there have been times in the past when you have helped our county do its job better. I remember the Illy Egg Farm out in Shandon. with the nitrate impact of a city of 40,000 people, essentially in the form of a chicken farm, with the mitigation being tarps and hoping to sell the product somewhere. And this was also on a negative declaration in our county. But fortunately, between you and the State Water Resources Control Board, the conditions kind of discouraged the applicant from going forward with this extremely low-tech solution. And I also am thankful for the involvement you took in relation to the land application of sewage sludge near the community of San Miguel, where you actually took on lead agency status when the county didn't care to. And so I welcome the role that you have, sometimes looking over the shoulder of our county and helping it do its job better. And I know that we'll get a good result in this case as well. Thank you.
Well, it's too bad everybody doesn't share those thoughts.
I don't always agree with your decisions, but I welcome your role.
You have a good memory.
Thank you. Okay. Is it Peter Brewer? And one more card is Mr. Payne. All right.
Hi, my name is Peter Brewer.
Hang on one second. We need some more cards. Did you want to? You did.
I'm Lois Sargent.
Oh, well, that was the one that didn't was not filled in with a name, and that I that one didn't have a name. So,
Mr. Brewer, let him speak.
You're off the hook.
That's okay.
Yeah. All right.
Sorry, you're already timed up.
Probably is. Yeah,
I'll
I guess the buzzer went
off. I'll
put
your name here, and you'll be the last speaker. Okay. Mr. Brewer.
Yes, my name is Peter Brewer, Wastewater Committee member on Los Alsos, also Grants Committee chair or member in Los Alsos, and also Bon Vivant. I guess I was reading the paper today. I'm one of those odd people actually get his news from the blogs and the news as it happens. The Tribune had a couple interesting articles. One of them, I guess, was about a creek that I guess they want to change the use of in San Luis. I'm not really scientifically in tune with all the what they're describing. But apparently they want to change the creek and say it's not drinking water anymore, and the board has decided, hey, you know, you can't do that. This is really bad because that stuff goes in aquifers and this and that. Interesting I noted was the Tribune talked about, well, you know, in the near future, the law is going to change. You're going to have to start producing drinking water. Basically, the way it's described to me is we have to put water into the ocean that's cleaner than what's already there. In addition to that, I guess they use some technology, trifluorohalides. I guess that's going to be illegal, too. I couldn't help but notice on the project for Morro Bay that they were going to be using that. And if you give them 10 years down the road, basically the technology they're implementing is illegal. The other thing that sort of crossed my mind was I thought about it. I said, you know, there's this other article, and they were talking about in Los Alsos and everywhere in the county. So I just want you guys to just sort of consider that when you think about the CDOs and how you're going to approach them. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Mr. Payne.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon, board, staff, public. I'm a resident of Los Osos. I have a CDO. I'm number 1,000. I was a little bit, what would we say, visible during recall. It was one of my projects, or I worked hard on that project. It was a group effort. Where do I start? Everything that's happened since we started recall has been to force us to build this outrageously expensive, incomplete project at the Tri-W site. It's not a good project. The other thing is, well, I could name them off. Number one, we had a 318 lawsuit. We went to Judge Hilton for a restraining order. Ordinarily, they're 90 days. We only needed 20 days till election. In ordinary circumstances, when there's irreparable damage done, the restraining order is granted. That's in the law books that I studied. It was denied. The appeal took enough time that they tore up the Tri-W site, before we got to appeal, which was rejected. Then we go to the illegal loan. Our old board was able to get funding for a project subject to funding. They signed contracts subject to funding. And then when the board was recalled, we were no longer funded. Everything pointed to all you have to do is start the project at the Tri-W site with Montgomery Watson's worthless plan that cost $160 million plus. One of the problems and one of the reasons it's so expensive, well, I go on one more thing. After that, we get fined for the three units at the CSDs responsible for. This is $6 million fine against our community. The next thing is the CDOs. And one of the members that got a CDO came in and asked, and some staff member said, he says, what do we do to stop these CDOs? And he said, well, go tell your CSD to start the project at Tri-W. So here we are. Everything that's happened since our new board, or since it was obvious that the old board was through and we did not want that project, everything has been trying to force us to have it. One of the things that was described about this project, it was right above the bay. And Mr. Young said it January 5th, I believe it was, that there are a lot of plants that are closer to the ocean than we are. We're not close to the ocean. We're above a bay by a few thousand feet, and that bay turns into a mud flat. It's silted full. It turns into a mud flat for 3 hours out of every 11. Some days there's three times it turns into a mud flat for 3 hours. Spill. But it was all right because during the dry season, they processed millions of gallons without a spill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Payne. Ms. Sargent,
yes,
you're the last speaker.
Oh, okay.
Unless there's anyone else in the audience who wishes to address the board at this time. Okay. Go ahead,
I'm Sargent. Lois Sargent, partner of the fellow over there for 56 years. Anyway, my family were in Baywood Park in 1959, and it was the best water. My brother used to come in from San Luis and jug it up to take it in because it was better water than San Luis. It was purported to be the best water in California. And I listened to people that went after the recall, and they said, there's nothing wrong with my septic tank. And I go, septic tanks are out, particularly in that dense of an area anymore. You can't do it anymore. We watched Balboa Island, and their system was all going down the tubes, and you have to take care of your own business. And I resent, I have a CDO, my husband and I do, and I'm not scared to death, sorry. And I'm not rich either, but things change, and you knuckle down and do what you have to. And the other one I want to say is save water. If you want to punish us, I think what you should do is make every owner in Los Osos get a front-loading washing machine. I think we all should have them all over California. Use less soap. We'd have more water to share, and I might be able to add on to my house. Also, I swam for 15 years. I was a body surfer at Brookhurst Beach, right in front of the outfall plant. And I must say, we got little funny things all over our skin. But that was in 1960. And I'm still alive. So I guess it's okay. So anyway, I just hope that we, you know, I was all for the Tri-W. I want the Tri-W. I knew it was going to get done. And the more we fought, the more expensive it got. And whatever happens, you know, I don't hate anybody in Los Osos. I mean, the one thing this has done is brought Democrats and Republicans together to fight against Democrats and Republicans. So that's kind of exciting. So that's it.
Thank you for your comments. Okay. There's no more cards up here. And I guess there's no one else in the audience that wishes to address us. Oh, sir, come forward.
I apologize for not having filled out a card earlier.
Okay. You can just identify yourself.
I'm Anton Vesely, Los Osos resident since October in the PZL. And I just wanted to make a couple of comments about the proposed pumping plan. As I have read the materials that I have received from the CSD office, things that I've downloaded from the State Water Board site, in there, I just kind of focused on some of the numbers, and I thought I saw that the main, one of the major objectives of the pumping would be to reduce bay nitrate levels. And I believe the target was to reduce bay nitrate levels by 12%. Most of the nitrates come from again. So in that, you buy 3 non-leaching days out of 60 days, and that only comes, by my calculation, to 0.5% reduction in everything coming out of that septic tank and leaching into the ground. So that's a pretty low figure compared to a 12% reduction. Maybe my math is wrong. Maybe there are other things that go into the calculation. But I'm going to study this some more myself. I'll be probably asking for guidance about how the expected reduction numbers were calculated to clarify things. But in any case, if it's a questionable end result, and to me it is, the total cost of the pumping over potentially 3 full years is going to total $27 million. And that's money that's just going to get sucked out of our wallets and for a reduction of 0.5%. And it contributes nothing toward a permanent sewer solution. Those of us who have to pay for that bi-monthly pumping, or pumping every other month, that money, you know, it's out the door. It could have gone to help build a sewer, basically.
Thank you for your comments.
You're welcome.
Ms. Schicker, come forward.
Am I the last speaker?
You're the last speaker.
Oh, wow. Thanks. Just trying to get off work. Thank you. Lisa Schicker, president of the CSD. I know there were some speakers before me. I apologize if I repeat, but just from the CSD and as a citizen, I would ask you to please reconsider the CDO actions and take a look at what we're doing so far. And did you get an update from anybody else? So there are some things we're doing. We're starting to pump the upper aquifer, like we said. We're meeting with your staff. Great, good meetings, productive meetings. And we're going ahead on the project. We approved a team last night for a project report to get going on that. And we're working on septic tank management program. Even though we don't have the authority, that still rests with the county. We've been working with Assemblyman Blakesley to get some special legislation for that, to get that going. We'd like to have that authority to help get that program going. So we put in a resolution with the county and Assemblyman Blakesley to have you and us and them all get together at a table and start discussing and trying to come up with a solution for our town. So just wanted you to make sure that you knew those things, and we do think that the CDO effort detracts from our efforts and our resources to be able to work on a project, which we're totally committed to doing, and I wanted you to know that.
Okay. Thank you for your comments.
Thanks very much.
Okay, anyone else? All right. We are finished with public forum. Did we want to do closed session, Ms. Oaken?
We have some other items.
We do, okay.
We need to go back to, I suggest we go to item
14.
Why don't we go to item, where is it?
There's not many left.
17. Coming back at our June meeting with a more detailed description of where we are. But we wanted to take the opportunity today to go over with you our development of our attempt to come up with a tangible vision for the Central Coast region, something that's farther sighted than all the daily issues that come before you, the monthly issues that come before you. And so we have our overall vision, which is described here, and Michael's going to go over our handful of goals for that vision. And then what we're really working on currently at a staff level are the individual objectives. But and we've written some of this up in our staff report, and Michael's going to highlight that as soon as he can get to the right page here. And here.
Got it.
Okay.
Thanks, Roy. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, this is an update on our Water Board vision and measurable goals. Last spring, we started talking to the board about this, and we asked the question, what will the Central Coast region look like in 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, and what physical condition will we leave behind when our careers are over? The mission of the board is to protect beneficial uses for future generations, and we're asking the question, are we actually doing that? We mentioned before that we have two choices: protect resources for future generations, which we think requires establishing this vision, developing a vision, and being proactive in achieving it. Or we can preside over the demise of resources using a passive or reactive approach, which is actually a pretty common approach with agencies and organizations in general, unless we consciously try to prevent that from happening. What we want to achieve is something like this, where we have a planning process, we work towards physical improvements in the real world, we measure those improvements, verify, report back to ourselves, in the public, in the board, and establish accountability, and keep going through this productive loop where we make sure that we include the physical improvement in the environment. So it's a constant evolving process where we are measuring the actual changes that we are bringing about. What typically happens is we truncate these important parts out here, and we have this more internal, inter-organizational type process where we're planning, we're listing issues, we're raising the alarm about those issues, trying to get more resources based on those issues, and then assessing and prioritizing it, and just keeping on going around and around in this. Could we grab the lights over there? So that process that I just talked about, that truncated process, this one.
Was that your desk?
Yes, this is my desk. I'm actually sitting behind it, but you can't see me. Right there. No, that's a room in our office upstairs, and every time I walk through this room, I think about the amount of energy that has gone into doing the work that is represented there. That's, I probably shouldn't admit it, but that's our library. And I think about all the energy and effort that's gone into that and how much real work resulted in that from that. I mean, changes in the wetlands. And as a result of that cleanup and abatement order, they changed their management practices greatly. And you can see the difference in these pictures. That's the exact same area 10 years later. And it's starting to recover, and it's starting to act or function as a natural ecosystem once again. Same thing here. It's a different area, but illustrating the same thing, restoring ecological function. We started last spring on our process of establishing a vision and measurable goals, and we got together with all of the staff who wanted to participate, and we've had about up to half of the office participating at different times. We developed, we brainstorm issues here in this room, and we pretty much covered most of the walls here with our flip chart sheets, where we kept track of all the issues that people came up with. We put them all up on the walls and so everyone could see them, and we have kept track of all of that information. We then got together again, and we developed issue statements from that brainstorming session, just a few issue statements. We tried to coalesce all that information into the big issues that are facing the region. Then we established work groups, and several staff members stepped forward and led those work groups, and they developed measurable goals from those issue statements. We then got together with the management team and the work group leaders. We established a vision, or developed the vision language or words that you see in the staff report and that you'll see in a minute here, and we revised those measurable goals. And some common themes that came out of this that many of the people kept bringing up throughout the process, and when I mean people, I mean staff here in the office, and that those are mainly protection for aquatic habitat, the fact that urbanization and land management practices are the big things affecting water quality in Region 3 and will be in the future. We need to do much more monitoring and assessment work, more than we have done in the past and more comprehensive. We need to update the basin plan, and we need to improve the organization. And you could talk, I put that, you know, improve the organization, that's a pretty generic term. You know, if you talk to 10 different people, you will probably get 10 different ideas about what that means. But we think of it in terms of improving the organization to achieve tangible results. So the going back and forth, when we were in our with our management team and the work group leaders, we went back and forth between the goals, the draft measurable goals that we came up with, and the vision language. And what we ended up with was that our vision for the future of the Central Coast is clean water, healthy coastal environments, and healthy functioning watersheds. And those photos there are of San Luis Obispo Creek, Big Sur, and the estuary, the Morro Bay estuary. So the measurable goals that we came up with, there are five of them, and it was interesting when the management team got together. We initially, as individuals, came into that meeting with our own draft measurable goals, what we thought they should be, and after several meetings and many hours, none of our measurable goals that we came into the meeting with, came into the room with, were there. You know, verbatim, they were all changed to produce this, which we think is collectively is better. So we've got five measurable goals. These are the first three. The first one, by 2025, 80% of the watershed riparian systems are healthy, and the other 20% are getting impact development. So limiting impervious surfaces is just one of them. So this is an issue that will continue to be debated within our office, but we think it's an important goal. The third one, by 2025, 80% of the land within a watershed will be properly managed to support a healthy, functioning watershed, with the remaining 20% achieving a positive trend. Number four, 80% of groundwater is clean, with the remaining 20% getting cleaner. And the last one, the Water Board will manage all discharges to ensure a healthy coastal environment for humans and wildlife. The last one, we actually had four measurable goals for a long period of time. And then towards the end of our process, a few people pointed out that we're leaving off the marine environment, and it's a big part of what we do, so that fifth goal was added. So there are three things that are common that came out of these goals and that are reflected in these goals that are really important. And one is protecting functioning systems. That first goal, we talked about protecting functioning riparian corridors. That's different than the approach we've used forever in the past, where we've focused on individual parameters. And it's kind of an end of the pipe sort of thinking, where an effluent stream needs to meet certain parameters. We looked at water bodies the same way, that the water bodies should meet certain individual parameters. But the approach we're going to now is more of a multi-parameter approach. And as an example, this is something that our regional monitoring program manager, Karen Worster, is working on, this biostimulatory risk index, which looks at several parameters. And we put them together, and we're looking at whether the system is functioning as it should with respect to these biostimulatory parameters. These are two sites. One here at Limekiln Creek is healthy with respect to this risk index, and here's another site at Franklin Creek where it is not healthy. And this is, I'm just putting this up here as an example of where we're going. We're going to add to this and include biological parameters and physical parameters for riparian areas.
How do we affect land use changes to reach some of these goals?
I'll get to that in the future, and you bring it up if I don't hit what you're asking for. The second thing is assessment. As I mentioned, we need to do more assessment, more comprehensive assessment than we have done in the past. And this leads to your question, is that we need to use tools like geographical information systems to track land management practices throughout our region. This is already being done on a certain scale. The California Department of Conservation tracks land use and changes in land use over time. For example, they track the conversion of agricultural use as agriculture designations to urban. And that work is important for us, but it's at too low of a resolution. We need a more higher resolution for a regional assessment and for us to actually use that data to determine what's going on in our region. That will be combined with the important, well, before I go to that, this is an example of using a geographical information type system to track changes in land use. This is a NOAA Coastal Change Analysis Program. They are currently implementing this program. It's focused on coastal areas throughout the United States. And this is the location of this is irrelevant. I don't even know where it is. I think it's back east somewhere. But it shows they are tracking development over time in coastal areas. And you can see this between these 2 5-year graphs, the significant increase in developed or urban area and the loss of natural habitat. This resolution is, again, too low for what we need. We need to do this kind of work on a higher resolution, and we're brainstorming now on how we can get that kind of data. But that's what we'll be using and tracking over time. It's directly related to that second goal of reducing impervious surfaces in watersheds. The third thing is trends. You'll notice in those goals that we talked about 80% of groundwater being clean and the remaining 20% achieving a positive trend. And the reason that this became an important issue in developing these goals is because we realized that we have problems in our region that are really big and that we will not solve or fix in our lifetimes. This is a map of our region showing the concentration of nitrates in groundwater. Most of every one of those dots you see up there, whether it's a green or red dot, is a well. And this is, I believe, is all DHS data. And if Karen is here, she can correct me on that, but I'm pretty sure this is all Department of Health Services data. We have analyzed the data for all of the red wells. We have not analyzed the data for the green wells. But for those wells that we have analyzed, most of those red wells exceed the drinking water standard for nitrate in groundwater. There's a lot of information on this graph, but I want you to ignore most of it and just focus on the fact that this is a 20-year trend. This is the data that you were just seeing on that map. And the 20-year trend shows this dramatic increase in the concentration of nitrates in groundwater in our region. And this is the kind of thing that we're talking about actually dealing with. You know, we realize that we can't fix this. We're not going to go out and clean up all of this groundwater and get all of this, get these concentrations below the drinking water standard in our lifetime because of the things that are currently in place that cause this, you know, the cultural and economic conditions that cause this situation. But we are saying that we should at least change this trend. If we could decrease the trend, cause it to go flat, or even have it going in the other direction, that's the kind of thing that we want to look at as far as an objective goes and think of the things that we could put into place to make that happen. So that's where that third thing that I mentioned about trends comes into place. Those are the three big things that came out of setting these goals for our region. Right now, we're working on objectives. The goals are big. They apply to our whole region over a long period of time. And those goals by themselves, without any more specific action items, really don't mean anything. So here's the first goal. By 2025, 80% of our watershed rights. That includes chemical, physical, and biological parameters. We're actually doing that now. We've put together a team led by Chris Rose to develop a basin plan amendment for protecting riparian areas, and it's based on using this approach. And Karen Worster is also working on this. We need to identify the tools and approaches to monitor and assess the riparian systems. I already talked about that. We need to implement that assessment work. We need to develop a basin plan amendment to implement the multi-parametric standard. That is when we define the goal, the target that we're after, we want to incorporate that into the basin plan. Identify all the regulatory tools that are available to us to implement this new criteria or this new standard for protecting riparian areas. That last bullet there, that's part of aligning the organization or aligning our programs and the things we do so that they are working toward achieving the goal. There are more objectives here. I won't read them. This is the second goal. 90% of the land within any watershed will be free of impervious surfaces. We need to define the design standards that must be implemented by municipalities to achieve the goal. We think this is largely done through the LID design standards that we already have that are available to us, and we are working with municipalities to implement those design standards. And Roger will be talking about that a little bit more in a few minutes. Again, develop a basin plan amendment to require the design standards or revise the general stormwater permit to do that. We don't know which one of these we will do yet or both, but that's a type of objective that we will be looking at. And again, similar to the last goal, identify the regulatory approaches, strategies, or tools that are available to us and align the organization so that our various programs and efforts are working in, you know, towards the same end. So the next steps, what we're working on right now is finalizing these objectives. And what I've showed are examples. Some of them will probably be will be put into final format and will look a lot like what you see here. Others will be new. But we're working on this now, and we plan on bringing those final objectives to the board in June at our off-site meeting, which I'm not sure what the location of that is yet. I don't think we've established that. And some other things that we're doing are working with municipalities to encourage low-impact development. And Roger, did you want to summarize that?
Yeah, actually, we did write that up in the staff report, so I won't dwell on it. But just to quickly summarize, with the city of Santa Maria, several of us went down to the city of Santa Maria, and with the idea of basically promoting low-impact development, not so much from the standpoint of as a regulatory agency, although we certainly try to tie it in with the stormwater program as much as possible, but mostly from the standpoint of trying to indicate to the city the benefits to the city of utilizing low-impact development. And one of the reasons that we selected these three cities here for initial efforts is because they're among the largest cities in our region and they're among the fastest growing cities in our region, so they have a lot of potential in terms of growth. That doesn't mean that there is an opportunity for, I refer to it as redevelopment, and the city manager of Monterey a task for that because he said they don't have any redevelopment. What we're talking about underway by way of Kennedy Jenks, I believe, and it's not just going to be for the city of Salinas. It'll be a template that will be applicable to other cities as well. We're working with the city of Paso Robles. Dunaway and I just went up there last week to Paso Robles, met with the mayor, and there was some guy named Brad Hageman involved in the meeting. And that was basically kind of an introductory session as to what we wanted to get into in more detail along the lines that we did with the Santa Maria meeting, and to hopefully get the mayor and the key staff really interested in proceeding, and I think that went well. Going back to the city of Salinas, we wrote a pretty aggressive letter to the city of Salinas regarding the stormwater program, and now they're a phase one city. They're the only phase one city in our region. And we said that basically we consider low impact development to be defined as maximum extent practicable. And there is an out to say or equal or words to that effect. But basically we're saying we think that you're gonna have to come up with something that is either low impact development or something that's better. And that's what's required as part of the stormwater program. So, like I said, it was kind of an aggressive approach, and they seem to be in agreement with that, and they're proceeding with this ordinance development. So we're going to be having a bigger scale meeting with the city of Paso Robles. That's coming up. We told them about the Salinas ordinance that's going to be applicable to other cities, and they were glad to hear about that. So those are some of our interim efforts that we're trying to push the ball forward, even though we have the grander vision development and goals and objectives underway in a longer time frame. But with some of the examples that Michael had for riparian corridor improvements, obviously we've been doing that for 11 or 12 years because you saw the results. And it's the same thing with low-impact development now. We're trying to carry those forward on a parallel course rather than doing these things sequentially.
Okay. The last thing that's mentioned there, the LID, low-impact development grant proposals. I mentioned in the staff report that we received several of those. That's a result of Donette Dunaway also doing a good job of getting the word out to municipalities that grant funds are available. So we're really happy to see that we are receiving some of those grant proposals, and they are now in the system and being analyzed for funding. They're being ranked right now.
We should, pardon me, put a link on our website or something on there, not even a link, but put our projects in the region that are, you know, advancing low-impact development and are good examples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can do that. If they're not on there already, we can do that.
Right, maybe they are.
Mm-hmm. I know you have those three cities up there, but I'm just thinking as we had Gonzales's wastewater this morning, and they are pretty aggressively developing as well as Soledad and Marina, those areas. We should also contact those cities before they get too far along in their development process. And also probably we should send a notice to all the LAFCOs in the particular counties, mm-hmm. because they look...
I doubt... Not willingly. I have a question, Michael, if you could go back. Is this the last slide?
No, I think there's one or two more.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's go back. Did you want me to go back?
Go ahead, once you finish.
Okay. A couple other things. Getting the word out, that's a good segue. Roger and I met with the director of the Water Education Foundation a couple of weeks ago. They published this brochure that I think all of you have. It's called Western Water. And they do highly professional publications and public outreach work. And we met with them as part of the process of brainstorming and trying to figure out better ways and new ways to get information like this out to the public and to municipalities. So we want to establish a working relationship with this organization. It's a nonprofit organization. Set some funds aside, probably from SEP projects, and do projects with this organization to get the word out on various things that we're working on, and especially low-impact development. So we're working on that as well. Roger mentioned the low impact. I think you mentioned the low impact development workshop that we did. And it's also mentioned in the staff report.
Actually, I didn't.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
It's in the staff report.
It is in the staff report, and we are brainstorming whether we need to do that again. The chairman mentioned doing that in the northern part of our region as well. So we're considering that and how the best way to do that, and perhaps working with an organization like this, the Water Education Foundation, to do it. Another thing that we're working on is educating ourselves, educating staff here in the organization. And we're working with the director of the executive program at UC Davis. His name is Gene Crumley. He has a great deal of experience in helping organizations improve and become more performance-based. And part of that effort, we're trying to bring the entire executive leadership program that is taught at UC Davis here to our office. And it's a 9 or 10 week program at Davis. We're involving 9 or 10 classes. We want to bring all of those here, and it will probably be spread out over a year, but it's part of the picture, part of the effort to make us more of a performance-based organization. And we're working with Gene to actually tailor that program to us and what we are trying to accomplish here. Okay. Tam Dodak. I think that's how you pronounce her name. Dodak. She's the new chair of the State Water Board. I thought this was interesting and we should put it up here. She said, "My paramount goal as chair of the State Water Board is to ensure a performance-based organization that delivers results, not only in doing our job, such as adopting policies, issuing permits, et cetera, but in demonstrating actual measurable improvements in compliance, water quality, and beneficial uses." And, you know, I read that and I said, good, it's about time. That's what we need to be doing. That's what this is about. And I think that we're on the right track. I think that we're looking at making changes in the real world, measuring what those changes are, reporting those changes back to ourselves, to the board, and to the public, and eventually we're going to actually presenting the measurements, the actual data.
Foundation folks, and this is a little bit of a side note that is not as directly related with the overall vision, but it's more stormwater related. One of the reasons they wanted to meet with us is to say, here's what we do. Do you see opportunities for them to utilize their resources? And one of the things that we pointed out is that all of our stormwater permittees, and we got a lot of the phase two stormwater permittees, as you're well aware, that are just kind of coming online now. We're trying to get them online. And they all are required to do this educational component. And yet a lot of the cities are not equipped to do that. That's not something that they necessarily normally do, especially some of the smaller cities. So one of the things we talked about is if they could come up with something that would, again, be sort of a template sort of presentation, maybe different media that a lot of the cities could use, that might be a real benefit. And there's a big universe of phase two communities that are required to do this, not just in our region, but elsewhere in the state and the nation for that matter. So that was, I think, fortuitous timing to get together with them and realize that there was a potential mesh there that would be mutually beneficial. And then Tam Dodek's statement there and what Michael was just saying in terms of some folks in Sacramento being interested in this, I was going to mention this during the EO report, but the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting is coming up, and that's scheduled for April 24th, 25th. And we were asked if we could present our work on our vision development and our work on becoming a performance-based organization because of that statement by TAM. And the reason we were asked is because, as Michael said, we've kind of advertised that we're working along these lines. So it's coming around the horn. They've actually asked our chair if he could present something on that. So we'll have to work together on that. But it's, again, indicative of the TAM's statement and the fact that, we think we're on the right track, obviously, but it looks like maybe some of the folks at the state board think we're on the right track as well. There's a tie-in with our vision development with being a performance-based organization, in that part of the idea of making a change towards tangible results in the organization is to institutionalize those the vision and those goals and objectives. And one of the ways to institutionalize it is to have that reflected in individual performance goals and evaluation of how we're doing as individuals towards achieving those goals. So we've done things like refining our performance evaluation criteria to align it more with our attempts to realize this vision. And we're already starting to implement that. So anything else to add, Michael?
No, but I wanted to make sure that I answered your question about how would we track land use changes and how would we regulate that?
Well, actually, not that. We can go back to that slide. And, yeah, the question was more about not the tracking. I think what I picked up is that we don't know what the current status is. It has it's the timeline.
In 2025?
Well, yeah, it's one of those. There's no backwards. No, it's the one that one. Okay, so it's going to take us 2.5 years.
Yeah, remember these are examples.
Right, I understand.
Yeah, so and the timelines are examples. So right. We put the times on there just to give you an idea of what we're thinking about in terms of when we establish an objective. We're not talking about doing it in 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Right.
We want these to be short term, and you know, obviously we want to be as short as possible. Right.
Give me an example, like for the very last item, what would a standard be, for instance?
The last bullet, identify all regulatory tools?
Yeah, right, that we can use to implement the standard. What is the standard?
If the standard...
The multi-parametric standard, what...
If we use this multi-parameter approach that we're talking about and we establish the target, right, we say when we're considering all of these parameters, this system will be a healthy functioning system if it meets this target, a defined target. And what is the target? I'm going to try and find my own slides here.
Yeah, okay.
See, it'll be defined in this type of analysis, where you want it to be, the results, you want it to be as tight around the center as possible. And we'll define what that is, what is acceptable and what is not. There's a point at which, when you get away from the center here, where the system is no longer functioning. And we can describe what that is. I don't know what it is yet, but we know that this one is probably not functioning. Is Karen here?
Okay. So each of the five constituents, each of the five constituents on the bottom left-hand quadrant are the points of the pentagram.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't make that clear. Okay. Each one of these is an axis that represents one of these parameters. And I don't want to give you the impression that this is it. This is the measurement we're going to make. This is only part of it.
Right.
We're going to add biology, and we're going to add the physical parameters, like geomorphology.
Okay, there's some areas that we historically have not really been involved with, like land use practices.
Mm-hmm.
So how far... imagine we are going to go in terms of trying to dictate or encourage?
Our irrigated ag requirements say that farmers have to use best management practices. And we don't define those in specific terms. We don't say this is the specific management practice that you must use, and I don't think we want to do that. But we do want them to use best management practices to control the discharge of pollutants from their property, and we will measure that to see whether they are doing it or not. You know, right now, the farmers are reporting that information to us. They're saying, for the most part, I think they're saying, yes, we are doing it. Yes, we are using best management practices. But we have to evaluate whether that's true or not, and part of that evaluation is water standards. The standard is there, you know, to keep the stormwater on site and to let it infiltrate back into the ground.
So we might see something in the basin plan.
I think it could be in the basin plan. It could be in the next stormwater permit, the next general permit. I think it's going in that direction. You know, Celeste Cantu, she sent out a memo several months ago that said low-impact development should be one of the board's highest priorities, establishing it, pushing it, making it a reality.
That was associated with the consolidated grants program, I believe, to indicate that they would basically get extra points as far as grant applications go.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Sounds like things are on a roll, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so for each of those measurable goals, you have the same, you know, kind of timeline set out.
Yes. The objectives will have different timelines, you know, the shorter term, different timelines, and they'll be different for under each goal. But we'll talk more about those specific objectives in June.
Good. Okay. Any questions from the board? No? All right. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
For this item.
Okay. Mr. Dugan?
Yes.
You wanted to address the board on this item?
Yes, I did.
Tam, did you comment on there? I was well pleased with that. I want to talk about the watershed program for Los Osos Valley, how this may be affected. You may be getting a project from Los Osos that may incur having ponding and wetlands out in Los Osos Valley, which, of course, is the watershed program. Is all involved with that. I can't say that's what you're going to get, because we still have a ways to go. But we're working on wetlands, bonding wetlands and egg exchange. And hopefully in those areas we'll be able to bring down a lot of the problems we have with agriculture, where they're loading the runoff into our creeks and stuff, and it's ending up in the estuary. I had written an email to Sorrel Marks wanting to converse on her about the watershed program for Los Osos itself, and she says that we're part of a greater plan. And so I went towards the and looked at that information and found it really lacking in the area of drainage, in the area of Los Osos itself as far as runoff is concerned. I'm on the water committee for Los Osos as an alternate. And we've only met once. But what I am trying to achieve with this water committee is to point out to them that it's about the water. Wastewater is a big deal because that's our byproduct. But we need to take control over our watershed management as well. And we need to be a part of that, those decision makings. And I believe that our sphere of influence, or at least where we can speak towards that, will be perhaps a project out there with wetlands, but also to be involved with decision makings as well as granting and funding for drainage for Los Osos, something that's been not really looked at. The politicization of your guys' function here, I'm in both staff and the board, I do not believe have politicized their actions. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Okay.
Item number three, unless there are questions.
Item number three?
Minutes.
Okay. Back to item number three.
Just for the January.
January 5th, 2006 minutes.
Move to approve.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
And item
14.
This is our written report on enforcement status or violations. Any questions?
No, they waited until he was finished.
Mr. Chair, through you to Mr. Briggs.
Right, yes.
I see the Department of Corrections is starting to build up number of violations again. Are we proactive on that? So they have eight.
Well, the effluent violations are, many of them are subject to mandatory minimum penalties, which have been before you probably three times, I guess. And the of course, they've had a treatment plant and trunk line project under construction for quite some time. I forgot the timing on that completion. Anyone remember that?
It's May this year, very soon.
May, okay, in 2 months we're supposed to be done with that project. Thanks, Matt. Help. Along those lines, actually, Sorrel Marks wanted to point out, I'll go ahead and point out that the city of Pismo Beach has completed their upgrade project, and Sorrel went down there a week or so ago and checked it out.
Just want to correct, they're not completely finished with the project, but the new facilities are up online and getting some excellent results with the effluent quality. They're just finishing up their chlorine contact chamber.
Okay. And they were, that was a facility that was in a similar boat as CMC with a lot of violations and the project underway to get them back into shape.
Is there a standardized way to christen a new plant? Do they break a bottle of champagne over a clarifier?
It's a bottle of supernatant.
Supernatant, right.
I believe they're having a christening in a couple of months. I'm not sure exactly what the date is.
Okay.
Any other questions? I will say that we've, with our enforcement unit, which consists of Matt Thompson and Todd Stanley, led by Harvey Packard, we do have a bit of an increased focus on enforcement. We have regular sessions to take a look at all the violations that we have, what the priority of those violations are, what the priority of follow-up enforcement actions should be, enforcement, and should be able to do things more efficiently and get them out the door faster.
Okay.
For that item.
Item 19?
Item 19 is the...
Did you have my notes? On my meeting?
Yes.
Meeting before?
Yeah. Can I send those? I forgot to send them.
Yeah.
Can I explain the background for that?
Sure.
And then maybe Lori wants to jump in, too. What Chairman Young is referring to is he sent me some notes from a meeting that he had with, it happened to be Rob Almy, but the reason for sending those notes to me is that from the chief office of the chief counsel, there was a directive that through the attorneys to let you board members know that, first of all, of course, if you're to avoid ex parte contacts, and that would be for something that's coming, that's on the agenda or is coming up soon on the agenda, but even for other conversations, for something that is not necessarily on an upcoming agenda, if you have conversations with something that has to do with region board business, then the chief counsel would like you to publicly describe that contact. And so I talked to Chair Young about this and said that it seemed like the two options for doing that would be to bring it up during this item of regional board reports, bring it up orally if you want to, or if you want to send something in writing to me, either email or hard copy, ahead of time so that I can disseminate it. I have to do a better job than I did with your notes that you sent. But that way it would save in terms of discussing that during the board meeting. But that's something that the chief counsel has asked you to do henceforth, and I think someone wants to add to that.
Sounds unconstitutionally vague and broad. Is there a definition of what board?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
First of all, on avoiding ex parte contacts, they're prohibited for quasi-adjudicative matters. And so you just shouldn't have them. If you get inadvertent communications or emails, just forward them to Roger and I. For legislative matters, which is basin planning and TMDLs, also any sort of policy decision, ex parte contacts aren't prohibited, but they have to be made part of the record. So for something like that, you know, if you happen to get a phone call on a TMDL that's going to come before the board, the appropriate time to make that disclosure would be during that item so that it can become part of the record. I'm not sure what Roger was talking about, writing up notes and disseminating them. If they're just being disseminated to the board members, I think that that actually makes it worse, not better. I think the idea is for public disclosure, but if there's any question about whether things should be disclosed or not, then I think that's a good place for us to weed this out so it doesn't become a three-hour item. If you go to a seminar, if you're attending the Marine Protection Act Task Force meetings that Fish and Game is doing, those sorts of things, which are pretty tangential to what we do, I don't see any reason to disclose that unless you think it's something that your other board members would be interested in hearing about, or whoever is left of the public when we get to this item. I think that...
Possibly, mm-hmm. And if there's any questions, then I just refer that person to Mr. Briggs, especially the press.
Yeah, that's a good point. And sometimes you can tell from the context, and you can ask people, but...
Some people have a way of starting out one direction to get to their point,
right,
which they want to put a point over on a certain project that's coming before us. But by the time that you get into it, realize what they're doing, is putting a stop to it is sometimes hard.
Right. So just let us know about those sorts of things.
Well, I did have a meeting with Rob Almy, he's with a water agency in Santa Barbara County, but he's
Project Clean Water.
Project Clean Water, but probably the head person for their swamp, phase two swamp. Now, they're not on our agenda, but they are going to be at some point in the next couple of years. But I have...
Hopefully months.
Hopefully months, yeah. Well, we've got to get through Monterey first. And so, but I ran into him as his daughter is in a class with my daughter in high school, and he had listened to, like I think a lot of the phase two permittees are, the Monterey swamp. I mean, the other agencies out there really want to know what we're going to do with this phase two permit. So he had actually got a hold of the tape and listened to it a few times. You know, they're very interested to know why it's taking so long to get this phase two permit going. And I guess it's the first phase two permit that could be appealed to the state board.
As far as I know, yeah.
Yeah. So I met with him to find out what was on his mind. And I wrote up notes for that. So I think when this does come on the agenda and we do have our hearing, then I'll go ahead and disclose that again, that I had met with him and what we talked about. Very little actually dealt with Santa Barbara's own particular situation. Most of it was kind of his concerns about where he saw the board getting with its kind of involvement with the details of the swamp for Monterey, you know, like monitoring. He said, you know, it's not required for phase two permittees, which is what staff told us. But he said, you know, it's not, typical monitoring isn't required. He then got into, because, you know, we started in with this question period about costing out BNPs. And, you know, how are they being, you know, how did Monterey pick the BNPs that they put forth? And Rob had told me that for any permittee, you know, that could be a very difficult situation to figure out because they're typically doing certain things anyway that they're just folding into a BNP type activity. You know, he said when he listened to, you know, Fred Meyer, is that his name?
Fred Muir.
Fred Muir, you
know,
city manager of Monterey, say very little to some of our questions about BNPs and cost. He said, I wouldn't know what to say myself. It's kind of a sanitized.
Right, Coastal Commission, are you speaking?
Oh, I won't mention any particular agencies, but I'll be able to tell you what we spoke about. Anyway. Next item is, last but not least.
Least but not last.
Drum roll.
Yes.
The EO's
awaited
report.
For.
Yeah, item 20, the executive officer's report. I want to mention a few things. We met, let's see, Harvey, and I met with the Pajaro Sunny Mesa folks regarding their desal proposal up in Moss Landing. It was Harvey and... we have with us?
Peter.
Thank you. Peter Von Langen of our staff. And we met with three reps from Pajaro Sunny Mesa. They're in a bit of a competition with CalAm on this desal project. And that'll be coming before the board once they're going to run a pilot project, as is CalAm. And then they'll have a full-scale project, and so those will be before the board as far as permit action coming up. We've been working with the sanctuary, the Monterey Bay Sanctuary, regarding a revision of the memorandum of agreement. It's a multi-agency. It's not just us. It's the State Board, Coastal Commission, EPA, Sanctuary, a couple others, I think. It's an agreement that we've had since 93, basically since the inception of the sanctuary. And this is just an update because things have changed in the last 13 years or so. So mostly Lori and Harvey and I have been working with the sanctuary and with Region 2 and the State Board staff in terms of getting the procedures right and the sanctuary was interested in some changes, and basically what we're trying to do is make sure that we can provide the information the sanctuary is looking for, but in a way that's melded in with our processes as much as possible, so that, that we're not creating new reports if we can avoid that, just using existing methods. Well, let's see. Michael already talked about meeting with the Water Education Foundation, and I already mentioned a couple other meetings here. We have a meeting coming up in the Salinas area, and this has to do with, again, the sanctuary is organizing this meeting. It's related to agriculture in particular, and I've contacted most of you by email about the potential for this meeting. We just heard in the last couple of days that it seems to be, first it was scheduled for an earlier date and it was postponed. The date that we have now is Wednesday, April 12th, beginning at around 8 o'clock and ending around 3, somewhere in the Salinas area. They're still working on the details. We're going to meet, and I'm planning on going to this as well. We're going to meet at the initial location. There'll be some discussion to kind of set the stage. The message I got is the main focus is on what it takes to get agricultural water quality management practices on the ground. That is the role of education and technical assistance, how the ag waiver was developed. And of course, we know that. We'll be there. Somebody from UC Extension will be there. And let's see, what else here? How the program is designed to promote implementation, provide feedback through monitoring, et cetera. That is the ag condition ag waiver. And then they want to go to about 3 ag operations to kind of show the on-the-ground best management practices and how that's done. And there will be lunch. So I don't have a specific location yet. I did hear from Daniel Press that he was interested in attending if the date worked out okay. And both Les and Monica, you were both interested in attending, again, if your schedule allowed for it. Gary, you said you were interested in attending. And Russ, I know you're interested, depending on whether you can get away.
If we have 5, then we'll have
to notice it. Well,
I think it's important. As many of us are there, we can see those demonstration projects. That would be an advantage for us. But
yeah, if there's any chance that there are going to be 5 board members there, we'll just send out a notice, and if 3 or 4 show up, it's no big deal.
No, too long as you notice it, then
everybody. Yeah.
I imagine John might be there as well.
I can't remember if he said anything about the April 12th date. So that's that one.
Is it April 12th or 13th?
April 12th, Wednesday, April 12th.
Okay.
And again, we're not organizing this. It's a sanctuary,
right.
So.
But we're just waiting for finalization.
Yeah. And then coming up, you were just talking about not knowing what's coming up on our agendas. I did want to mention a couple of big items that are coming up. Of course, we know that the Morro Bay Cayucas item is continued. We're looking at May 11th, hopefully, for that one. That's also the date of the Monterey Regional Stormwater Management Plan. If we progress down the road satisfactorily, and we're going to know that within the next week or so, because we met with the Monterey Regional Swampers for a 2-day workshop, and Michael and a couple other staff went up for that, and it was a good session. We made a lot of progress. That was with NRDC and the Monterey Regional folks, and now the plan is to get back together and try to document those changes that we hope were where everyone's in agreement. And the date of that meeting is coming up here
next week.
So we should know by then, after that meeting, whether we're a go for May 11th or not. To have both of those, both Morro Bay and Cayucas and Monterey Regional Swamp, on the 11th would not be very doable unless the Morro Bay item is simmered down and all the parties are holding hands and singing Kumbaya, as board members Shellcross might. It's always gone. let's see. We're going to be looking at June for the offsite meeting. We're looking at June 8th.
Oh, yeah.
June 8th, if you can make a note that
try to have one on a Sunday or a Saturday, just because it kills 2 work days. And she said, okay, we'll take that into consideration. And lo and behold, that comes, Monday and Tuesday.
But so even at the last WQCC, that was voiced very loudly,
yeah,
that most of us preferred not to have it on a Monday and Tuesday because we most of us have an occupation.
that Friday and Saturday would be better,
right,
for everybody, our participation. When they do, they come back on Monday and Tuesday.
Right.
And I don't know if that happens, that most state water board members leave on Thursday afternoon to go home on Friday and Saturday.
Well, I'm going to ask her.
Friday corrections.
What's that?
He's looking for the comment. You know.
Okay.
And I'm not going to be able to make it on the 24th or 25th either. So
I can't.
Family wedding. Okay. Michael Thomas did volunteer to substitute for me, though. And remember from our previous item that we were asked to give a presentation at the WKCC. Okay. On the budget, the statewide budget, April 3rd, the state regional board budget will be before the Senate, and then April 19th before the Assembly, then back to the Senate again. And I think it's back to the Senate again because it's tied in with the bond stuff. That's on May 1st. The word that we get from state board staff is that we're kind of low on the radar screen in terms of issues with our budget so far. And no, state and regional boards. Well, it's good from the standpoint of that the Senate and the Assembly don't have a bunch of big problems with the job that we're doing. I guess it's bad from the standpoint that for the giant bond proposal, there really isn't much of anything in there for water quality. There's a bunch of water stuff, but it's related to levees and, you know, that kind of
thing.
And as far as our current budget, we're looking at about a 5% under expenditure at the rate we're currently going through February. But as we saw at the start of the meeting, we have several new staff, so we're thinking we're going to be pretty close to being on target for our budget. And that's all I have to report, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Briggs, I've been looking at the last several executive office report. What's happening with Arena Gulch and Frisbee Park?
Let's see. I think the main thing that's put with the Frisbee Park or Arena Gulch?
Well, it's obvious to me that there's some erosion being caused by that that's going into the Arena Gulch, which ends up in Santa Cruz Harbor.
Yeah.
And
the main thing that's going on with Arana Gulch in general is that with the board's enforcement action against the city for the big golf course, there's a supplemental environmental project which was coordinated with Bobby Haber.
Keep an eye on it from time to time.
One of the reasons that Peter goes up there is because we have a lot of issues that we're dealing with, that is complaints about the harbor dredging, which of course is related to sediment coming from the watershed in part. And those complaints about the dredging really have to do with hydrogen sulfide emissions from the decaying kelp and whatnot. It's really an air issue. And so in a lot of respects, we're deferring to the Air Pollution Control District and Ed Kendig up there. And Peter are in pretty constant contact with complaints that we're both receiving. And then there's some question about whether there's a pump station nearby, which is a wastewater issue, which is also in our ballpark, is contributing to the problem at times. But that's one of the reasons that Peter has been up there, is to check on that as well.
Okay. I'll ask the question again in a couple months.
Okie doke. We're making progress.
Okay. Are we ready to close the... Oh, Dr. Hunter.
Yeah, I have a comment that I would just like to make, not regarding the EOS report.
Should I put my glasses on?
No. Just take a minute. I just want to say a few words on public comment.
Right.
And what I'd like to do is remind members of the public that comments are most helpful to us when they focus on the issues and when they help to bring information to the process that helps us to make better decisions, better informed decisions. comments about individuals, especially derogatory comments, are not helpful to us at all. And I consider them a waste of time for the staff as well as for this board in these processes. In the year I've been on this panel, Chairman Young, you have maintained a very high standard in the way these hearings are conducted and in the manner in which these issues are discussed, and I respect that effort, and I hope others will too. Today we received comments in writing and both at the board that contained some derogatory comments about an individual, and I would hope that we don't see that kind of effort coming forward, especially considering that this matter isn't closed. And I want to see that the processes that we worked so hard to establish a professional and, really focused on facts and information, that we ask people to consider that and respect that effort.
And you're referring to Joyce Albright's?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it was very distressing to me. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, this is televised, so hopefully that word will get out. Those are good points to make.
All right. Anything else before we close this part of the board meeting and then go into closed session?
Right. We'll go into closed session and then open the doors back up if there's any member of the public who's still here, and then adjourn the meeting.
Okay. All right, so we're going to closed session right now.
What we're going to be discussing in closed session is substantial exposure to litigation and the Collegian item in the closed session agenda.
We're going to do that here, Laurie.
Our meeting is adjourned, and we will reconvene April 28th in San Luis Obispo. Thank you.